It's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 75 and fair. Wind is from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Wind will be from the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. It's 75 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather for Northeast Kansas.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer in for Scott Detrow. Election Day is a little more than a week away. Both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are making their closing arguments in what's shaping up to be an extremely close race for the White House. For a look at how the candidates are spending their final days on the campaign trail, we're joined now by NPR's Luke Garrett. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. Luke, the former president is holding a rally in Madison Square Garden with just 9 days left until the election. Does he think he will win New York? What's his strategy?
Yes, Trump does think he can win New York, and he said so at a September rally in Long Island.
And the reason I'm here is because it hasn't been done in many decades. It hasn't been done for a long time, but we are going to win New York.
In 2016 and 2020, the former president lost the Empire State by around 23 percentage points, and the latest polling average puts him 15 points behind Harris. Nonetheless, the Trump campaign is pouring a lot of resources and star power into tonight's rally at Madison Square Garden.
So why invest so heavily in this event if New York isn't in play for Trump?
Well, a look at tonight's guest list gives us some clues as to why. House Speaker Mike Johnson and New York Representative Elise Stefanik are joining Trump on stage tonight. Republicans won a handful of races between Long Island and Syracuse during the midterms in 2022, victories that narrowly won them control of the U.S. House. This year, five New York Republicans are defending their seats in really tough races against Democrats. So while Trump may not win New York, his campaign is working hard to keep Republicans in control of the House.
Okay, let's pivot to the Democrats. How is Harris spending her final week on the campaign trail?
Today, Harris is traveling through Pennsylvania, arguably the most important swing state. Harris is meeting with black church congressional congregations in West Philadelphia, part of the campaign's Souls to the Polls effort. The vice president is also spending a lot of time at neighborhood barbershops to speak directly with young black men, a voting bloc that the Harris campaign is really counting on. Polls show that young black men are increasingly curious and supportive of Trump and his campaign. Co-chair of the Harris Walls campaign, Cedric Richmond, tells NPR that he expects black men to coalesce around Harris because of her economic vision. Richmond says black men will decide this election.
And the message to African-American men, black men, is that, hey, you have a chance right here to take your future in your own hand, to determine what you want. And because you're such a key voting bloc, and because this race is going to be tight, you have an opportunity here to be difference makers and to determine who wins this campaign.
And Harris is holding a rally in Philadelphia tonight. And on Tuesday, Harris will deliver her closing arguments at the Ellipse on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The rally will be held at the same location where Trump spurred a march on the U.S. Capitol that turned into a riot on January 6, 2021. The vice president will focus on, quote, turning the page and moving the country forward, according to her campaign.
Luke, in these final days of the presidential campaign, what stands out most for you?
Both Harris and Trump have so little time left to get in front of voters, present their vision for the future, and then motivate Americans to take time to cast a ballot. So in these final days, it's time to go big or go home. The Harris campaign is doing this with rallies featuring superstars like Beyonce and Bruce Springsteen, all in the hopes of getting out the vote. For their part, the Trump campaign is making noise tonight with their rally at Madison Square Garden, a place marked with political history. In 1936, President Franklin D. Roosevelt gave one of his most important speeches at the New York venue when he rallied against the establishment. 3 years later, nearly 20,000 gathered there for a pro-Hitler rally in 1939. And in 1962, Marilyn Monroe sang Happy Birthday to 45-year-old President John F. Kennedy.
Well, a lot of history there. That's NPR's Luke Garrett. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, is someone we associate with Appalachia. He grew up in southwest Ohio and wrote a best-selling memoir about it called Hillbilly Elegy. But Vance's political influences stretch far beyond Appalachia, beyond Yale University, where he went to law school, beyond the San Francisco Bay Area, where he worked in venture capital, even beyond Washington, where he served as a senator for nearly 2 years, all the way to England, where I live. One of Vance's mentors is a philosophy of religion scholar at Cambridge University, and I went to his house.
Is that a Bible quote on the... And the leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nations, Revelation 22, verse 2.
His name is James Orr.
Hello, I'm Lauren. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
This is my colleague, Fatima.
Thank you so much for having us here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you are on the Faculty of Divinity at Cambridge University, alongside Old Testament scholars. I imagine you're an outlier, having the ear of a vice presidential candidate in the U.S.
I think that wildly overstates my influence on Senator Vance. If anything, he has been a mentor to me. We've had wonderful conversations over the years about politics, political philosophy, faith, religion. Senator Vance and I have a sort of camaraderie on trying to work out what the new right should look like in the 21st century.
How did you guys first meet?
We met through mutual friends, I think probably about 5-6 years ago. And actually, an American friend of mine came to speak in Cambridge, and he was predicting a Trump victory. This is October 2016, and we all thought he was mad. And he was brandishing a book by a certain J.D. Vance called Hillbilly Elegy. He said, Trump is going to win, and this is why.
And so you'd read the book before you met J.D. Vance?
Yes, I had. I thought that book was an extremely impressive diagnosis of a part of America that I wasn't so familiar with. But that I recognized in the course of the Brexit debates that we were having roughly the same time in 2016. Of course, Britain is not America, but there were certain reverberations and echoes in our situation here.
Some people accuse J.D. Vance of having sort of multiple personalities. He was very different in the vice presidential debate than he has been in some broadcast interviews. Who's the real J.D. Vance? Describe your friend.
When his candidacy, his nomination was announced, the press sort of swept in and started trying to find the least flattering soundbites and created this monster, this kind of monster collage. And so it's not as if he's got different personalities. I think what was shattered at the debate that night was this confected media picture of him.
He has changed his mind about Donald Trump, though. Have you watched that 180-degree turn? Did he talk to you about his changing views?
A lot of people have changed their mind about Donald Trump. No, I think what we've seen in Senator Vance's intellectual sort of evolution over the last 8 years is I think it's shown a great deal of courage and conviction on his part to be willing to stand alongside Trump at enormous cost. I mean, at the cost of effectively ostracism from the very elites that he managed to work his way up into.
You teach philosophy of religion. J.D. Vance converted religions to Catholicism. What are the conversations that you have about religion with him?
We've talked quite a bit about religion, but I think in Senator Vance's case, I think he flirted with a kind of pop atheism in his teenage years and early 20s, but his faith came alive again. And I think he saw in Catholicism a sort of an institutional vitality and an extraordinary intellectual hinterland.
And then this summer, J.D. Vance famously called the UK an Islamist country. Mm-hmm. Do you know why he said that? Like, the UK is, in fact, 60% Christian, only about 4 or 5% Muslim.
I think if you look at the direction of travel demographically in the United Kingdom, you have seen a very sharp uptick in where non-white, non-Christian parts of the population.
Islamist means something different, though.
Well, the UK has suffered over the last 20 years from a number of Islamist-inspired attacks.
But he called it an Islamist country.
Well, it was said plainly, playfully, and jokingly. And I had mentioned to him that 5 MPs were elected in July here on a pro-Gaza ticket. That is an extraordinary development in the history of in British political history. That's very puzzling. We're trying to work out what to make of all of that.
Senator Vance has said he doesn't care what happens in Ukraine.
a lot of British and European officials do. Is that a view you bring to your friend, a view from this side of the Atlantic?
My instincts are that the calculation of American interest on the question of Ukraine is going to be very different to the calculation of British or European interest, not least because we're 5,000 miles nearer the conflict, Senator Vance. He's often described as an isolationist, and I don't think that's fair at all. Like Trump, he is a realist in international relations, a realist of the old school. He believes that peace is won through a demonstration of strength, but demonstrations of strength needn't involve extremely expensive, costly wars in blood and treasure.
Last question I just have to ask. Childless cat ladies, what did you think?
I thought, I mentioned earlier, this complete caricature, this really ham-fisted attempt to demonize him.
But he said it.
He said it, and it was wildly ripped out of context. And I mean, I think it's a shame because he's got very, very sophisticated and well-developed ideas and concerns about the crisis of fertility that's affecting the whole world right now.
James Orr, Associate Professor of Philosophy of Religion at Cambridge University. Thank you so much for having us in your home.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Laura.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy npr.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. You have the power to make a lasting positive influence in your community through planned giving. If KPR has been important to you, please consider a planned gift to the station. For more information, contact your financial advisor or visit legacy.kansaspublicradio.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy skies, a low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy, highs in the mid-80s. For tomorrow night, clear with a low of 69, and on Tuesday, mostly sunny, windy, and a high of 82. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Vice President Harris campaigned in Pennsylvania again today at several spots across the city of Philadelphia. And former President Trump rallied at Madison Square Garden in the deep blue state of New York. He says he will win the state despite losing it by double digits during the 2016 and 2020 elections. The UN Security Council is expected to meet tomorrow at the request of Iran to talk about Israel's attacks on Iran this weekend, claiming they violate international law. Israel says it has a right and a duty to protect its citizens. And baseball's World Series picks up in New York tomorrow night, with the LA Dodgers leading the New York Yankees 2-0. But Dodgers star player Shohei Ohtani is questionable after he partially dislocated his shoulder in last night's game. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $60 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of more than 504,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer. Dozens of former British colonies are challenging their old colonial rulers to make amends for slavery and other injustices suffered under the British Empire. The idea of reparations was floated at this week's Commonwealth Summit in the Polynesian nation of Samoa. King Charles III was there.
I understand from listening to people across the Commonwealth how the most painful aspects of our past continue to resonate.
His government has refused to apologize, though, and says it's ruled out reparations in cash. But in their official communique released at the end of the summit, the Commonwealth leaders reiterated, quote, "The time has come for the reparations conversation." We reached Dan Bloom, senior playbook author for Politico in Samoa on the last day of the conference. And he told us that monetarily, it's not exactly clear what the Commonwealth countries want from that conversation.
But what they're asking is for the R word, reparations, to be sort of on the table. And that could mean, money hypothecated for, say, a museum to slavery or for projects to kind of turn around injustices. But it could also mean educational programs, holding off sort of the effects of climate change, especially in some of the small island developing nations, and sort of to generally better what is quite loosely termed the global south of developing countries, which just aren't as wealthy as the countries that historically profited from slavery and also from producing carbon emissions in sort of the industrial age.
Well, why have British royals and officials refused?
The king is technically and constitutionally not political. Now, the reason the UK government is not keen on this is because when you say the word reparations, people think of very large sums of money. And the new Labour government here, their whole kind of approach has been that they do not have money to spend, and this is simply not something that they can afford. And even when you ask them about reparations in terms of money for developing countries, projects in developing countries, which is something the British government supports, they say, we do not pay reparations, we are not talking about reparations. And the problem for them is that that word is very powerful to a lot of Caribbean countries, particularly. Britain came into this summit saying, this is not on the agenda. Now, at the end of the summit, Keir Starmer's only speech has included that nod to, I understand the strength of feelings on reparatory justice. So he is now talking about it. And the king, to swoop back to the beginning of your question, kind of referred to it in this quite diplomatic way in his speech. And that is quite significant because the king is kind of deployed to make these subtle, we're hearing you type messages when it's needed, kind of sparingly, which is kind of how the diplomatic double act in the British system works.
Dan, the idea of the word reparations formally appearing at this Commonwealth summit, what does that say to Britain?
It says that Britain does not have complete control of the agenda at the Commonwealth summit, and nor should it, because the whole point of the Commonwealth is that Britain no longer is an empire, and it is just one of 55 nations attending this summit, albeit a very wealthy and relatively developed one. And I know that we've recorded this interview before the communique has been agreed and it's being played out after. So I'll give you my prediction, which might not stand the test of time. But if by the time you're hearing this interview, the communique does have the word reparations in, that is a blow to Britain and Britain's hopes for this summit, because it didn't want this to be about the past. It didn't want the R word in. It didn't want this to be on the agenda. And a communique at the end of a summit is pretty much the definition of the agenda of a summit.
That was Dan Bloom, senior playbook author for Politico, joining us from Samoa. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The heavens will be busy tonight and tomorrow. NASA is expecting several interplanetary visitors to Earth's outer space neighborhood. The Center for Near-Earth Object Studies is keeping a close eye on 5 asteroids heading our way. So we should probably get to know them a little bit, yeah? The biggest one is asteroid 2020 WG. It's nearly the size of a skyscraper. It will probably make its closest approach at around 2 million miles away. Asteroid 2024 UQ1, however, is smaller, but perhaps more daring. It's about the size of a bus and should come within about 148,000 miles of Earth, which is a lot closer than our nearest space neighbor, the moon. But it's still not exactly the most convenient place for a bus stop. And just to be clear, all of these asteroids are expected to pass safely by the Earth and provide scientists with an opportunity to study them as they fly by. And now, as for whether we will get to see them, probably not, unless you have a really big telescope and a dark sky. Not long ago, we had an artist so the tiny desk that NPR Music wouldn't even tell us who was coming. My co-host Ari Shapiro was there.
I will always think of Dua Lipa as the pop star who helped us dance through the pandemic. Her last album, Future Nostalgia, came out when the world was locking down in March of 2020. And those tracks turned quarantine pods all over the world into private clubs. Well, now she's touring her new album, Radical Optimism. The Guardian newspaper just called her one of the world's great pop stars. And even though she can sell out massive stadiums, she recently came to NPR headquarters to play a much smaller venue, the Tiny Desk. To see my lovers in a good light. Don't wanna do it just to be nice. Don't wanna have to teach you how to love me right. Dua Lipa, thank you for joining us here at NPR.
Thanks so much for having me.
You said that one of the tracks you did in this performance, you sang in a way that you had never sung it before. And I would love to let listeners hear what it sounded like on the album. And now let's hear a little bit of what it sounded like when you did it just here at the Tiny Desk.
I'm not. You got everything you deserve. Oh, I must have loved you more than I ever knew. I'm happy for you. And looking back now, I hope you see it. Even the hard parts were all for the best. I see where you're at.
Tell us what that experience was like. What did you do? What did you feel?
You're good at this, isn't it? It was really special to reimagine the song and to take it kind of back to the music in its kind of purest form with no electronic production. It's just, it is what it is in the moment. And I think you just feel a song differently. You listen to the lyrics in a different way. And it was really fun to think about it and take it back to the basics.
I still loved you more than I ever knew.
This is a simplistic question, but do you find it easier to sing to an anonymous audience of faceless thousands or a daylit crowd of office workers?
I think maybe faceless thousands in a weird way, because even though when I get up on stage and I recognize faces and I see it, there's just so much happening. I'm dancing and I'm running and I'm moving and I'm, you know, I'm talking. And when you're just stood there in front of the microphone and you just can see eye to eye with so many people, it makes it so much more intimate. And I crave moments like that. I do, because it's just very real. And I get those like sweaty palms and my heart's racing. And yeah, it's just a beautiful feeling.
The song we heard, Happy For You, is a breakup song, but it's a joyful breakup song, which speaks to the title of the album, Radical Optimism. Mm. Is Radical Optimism something that comes naturally to you? Is it an aspirational title? Tell me about what it means to you.
I think aspirational is a good way to put it. It's the way that I like to think that I lead my life. It's like rolling with the punches. If something's not going well, it's okay, because you'll find a way to pick yourself back up. I always think about how I feel in hindsight, and after I'm going through a difficult thing and then a couple months later, I'm like, man, maybe I shouldn't have stressed myself out or upset myself as much as I did, because everything works out in the end. And I think that mindset has kept me very grounded.
Hmm.
I think a lot of songwriters have used the phrase, if these walls could talk.
Yeah.
But if these walls could talk, they'd say enough, they'd say give up.
But I'm not aware of any who have used it in quite the way that you use it.
It's not supposed to hurt this much, but if these walls could talk, tell us to break up.
Well, I thought it was fun to personify the walls.
Uh-huh.
Because no one knows you more than the four walls in your room, or the way that maybe other people might perceive a relationship. Like, they might look outwardly and be like, oh, everything's amazing, and, you know, they look so in love or whatever it is, and then in these four walls, it's like where all the truth comes out.
They tell us, go ahead, face your fears. It's getting worse the longer that we stay together. We call it love, but hate it here.
And I think those four walls are for everyone in whatever it is, whether it's a love relationship, friendship, work thing, whatever it is, it's there and it sees you in your most vulnerable, intimate self.
I also love that the phrase, if these walls could talk, summons ideas of kind of syrupy nostalgia, idealism, and you turn it on its head and inject it with humor, and they tell us to break up.
Yeah, well, it's like your agony aunt. Is your walls.
Agony Aunt is the advice columnist, is that right?
Yes, exactly.
So you ended on this great dance track, Houdini, where the member of your band who had been playing the child's glockenspiel instead picked up a little egg shaker, and you got the whole NPR office dancing.
I come and I go, tell me all the ways you'll need me, I'm not here for long, catch me or I go, Houdini.
And I just imagine when you are doing that in a sold-out arena, in a stadium, it must feel like you are conducting a symphony of tens of thousands of people. Can you speak to what that experience is like?
It's riveting. It's the thing that keeps me up until 4 o'clock in the morning after a show because the adrenaline is so high. It's the thing that I have dreamt about my whole life. And so when I get up on stage and I get to perform these songs and see people reacting, it just blows me away night after night. And I love being on tour. I love performing these songs. I love kind of seeing just people singing along. Like, it doesn't get old. For me and the shows that I like to do, it's like, how can I make sure that everyone's having as much fun as possible all the time?
It's a good mission.
That's my mission in life, is just have fun and make sure everyone else is having fun at the same time.
I need something that'll make me believe.
If you got it, baby, give it to me.
They say I come and I go. Tell me all the ways you need me. I'm not.
Dua Lipa's latest album is Radical Optimism. Thank you for bringing this dose of joy and fun to NPR and for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catch me or I go, Houdini. If you're good enough, you'll find a way. Maybe you could cause a girl to change her ways. Do you think about it night and day? Maybe you could be the one to make me stay. Let's go!
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Colorado River drought has been so bad for so long that places that were underwater for decades are now out on dry land and starting to grow plants again. Scientists researching those plants are finding thriving native ecosystems. Alex Hager from member station KUNC reports.
When you see a research paper, you see data and conclusions. What you don't see is this, the messy process of science in action.
I guess as an ecologist, I can't quite bring myself to just hack down vegetation.
In a narrow Red Rock Canyon in Utah, Seth Arns is gently pushing his way through towering, dense grasses, charting a path to his research site along the muddy canyon floor.
Oh, quicksand, quicksand. Oh.
What's the best way around?
You can go through it, but just quickly.
Arns is an environmental scientist, and getting to his research site requires about a mile of arduous trekking through the kind of desert heat that leaves you dizzy. It's in the triple digits under the southern Utah sun, but eventually the counting can begin.
12, 1, Baccharis salicifolia, 1.
Arns is producing the first ever serious data on what plants are living here. Tens of thousands of acres that are seeing the light of day after spending decades submerged under Lake Powell. In the mountains of silt left behind by the reservoir, it's mostly native plants taking root, the same kind that were last here in the 1970s, before the area was flooded.
And now not only is it not under the lake, but it turns out nature is doing a pretty good job by itself of coming back and establishing thriving ecosystems.
But it's unclear whether these new, thriving native plant communities might be drowned if Lake Powell's water level rises again. Its future is at a crossroads, as river managers debate new rules that will dictate how much water it should hold. The reservoir is unlikely to ever fill up completely again. Sarah Dant says that means now is a great time to study what the future might hold.
One of the things that is kind of astonishing about natural environments, almost regardless of where you are, is how quickly they can recover if they are able to.
Dan is a retired professor who studies the history of politics and the environment.
We have to be careful of our hubris in, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, managing nature, because you can cooperate with nature, but nature finds a way.
Zach Podmore, a journalist and the author of a book on Lake Powell's future, says nature is doing what humans couldn't, bringing back native plants in an area threatened by invasive species.
That's exactly what's happened in Glen Canyon over the last couple decades, but it's happened completely on its own.
And even though humans have spent millions on native plant programs around the region, we didn't need to intervene here.
The native species have been outcompeting the invasives in a really impressive way.
Podmore says, in a way, our struggles to manage a drying river are revealing an unexpected positive outcome of climate change.
Those trends usually go in one direction, right? The slow degradation of land. But what's happening in Glen Canyon is an ecological rebirth.
The next rules for managing the Colorado River are due in 2026, and they're expected to help write the next chapter for Lake Powell and the things that live in it. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Glen Canyon.
This is NPR News.
A therapy technique that involves looking at the self as multiple parts helped one man deal with his panic attacks.
The anxiety I've been feeling was one aspect of me, but not all of me. And in that moment, I felt this calm come over me.
We'll hear about a strategy to stress less Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. Just in time for Halloween, the Haunted States of America. Next time on KPR Presents, it's a cross-country trip of spooky stories. We'll visit with William Mockrey and Giselle Anatole about their contributions to this anthology for middle school readers. Also on this week's program, what role will split-ticket voters play in the upcoming election? It's part two of Beyond the Ballot from the Dole Institute of Politics. That's on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening, here on Kansas Public Radio, on KPR1 if you're listening over on KPR2, it'll be the BBC World Service. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy skies, a low of 57 degrees. Partly sunny for tomorrow and breezy with highs in the mid-80s. For Monday night, mostly clear, breezy, and a low of 69. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, online instruction available anytime, anywhere for students to catch up or get ahead in reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at ImaginableFutures.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer. Let's turn now to a true crime case that's captivated Britain, where I live. Lucy Letby was a neonatal nurse convicted of murdering babies in her care, one by one, quietly, often at night, at the hospital where she worked. The tabloids called her an angel of death.
Party girl, graduate, bright young nurse, Lucy Letby seemed like an ordinary woman. For evil hiding in plain sight.
Coverage is focused on her appearance, young and blonde, how she doodled the words, "I am evil, I did this," in her journal. But while Letby serves a life sentence, some forensics experts are now asking, did she actually do this? Or at least, did she get a fair trial? And to probe that question, I'm joined here in our London studio by the BBC's Stephanie Hegarty, who reported a podcast called Lucy Letby, The Killer Questions. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. So let's just dive into the evidence. On what basis was Letby convicted?
So this was one of the longest trials in English criminal history. It went on for 10 months. And she was eventually convicted on 15 separate charges, 7 murders and 8 attempted murders. And there was a huge amount of evidence. The police investigation went on for about 6 years, I think, from 2017 up until the main trial last year. So the backbone of the case, the prosecution's case, was that Letby was the only nurse who was always there when babies collapsed and some of them then died, when it was unexplained or unexpected.
So she was in the room. Were her fingerprints on, was there a murder weapon?
So this was a big problem with this trial. There was no forensic evidence and no eyewitnesses. No one ever saw Letby commit a crime. And instead of forensic evidence, what the prosecution really relied on was medical evidence. So the notes of the baby's conditions, nursing notes, medical notes. There were various different methods that she was convicted of hurting these babies by. One was injecting air into their veins. One was injecting air into their stomachs via their feeding tubes. Another was administering insulin when they didn't need it. And again, no one ever saw these things happening.
Some of those notes, there were also some journals. I mentioned these doodles of, I did this. I mean, seemingly really damning evidence. But later on, we found out that's not quite as it appeared.
This was a post-it note, and the image of it was shared really widely in the media.
Front
here in the
page
UK.
Of papers, yeah.
Yeah, and there was lots of scrawl and scribble on this post-it note, but there was one part where she said, "I'm evil, I did this." And that, on the face of it, is very damning.
It's chilling.
There was other things, many other things written on that post-it note. One of them was, "Why me?" One of them was something like, "I didn't do anything wrong." That wasn't reported as widely in the media. This was written in response to a prompt from one of her counsellors to, get everything off her chest, I suppose, a therapeutic kind of process.
And then that was used against her at trial.
The prosecution did refer to it repeatedly.
So what concerns are being raised now and by whom? She's already in jail. 15 charges.
15 yeah, whole charges. Life sentences. Yeah. Yeah, she's only one of 4 British women who has been sentenced to spend her whole life in prison. The backbone of the case is really based on statistics proving that one nurse is the only person who is always there when these things happen. You know, is it possible that one just happens to be on the ward more often? Is it possible that one nurse is working with sicker babies and therefore might be more likely to be there when a baby dies?
At trial, the names of the babies who died in Letby's care were given pseudonyms. So they were baby A, baby B, and so on. I think it went up to baby P or Q. That's a lot of babies, a lot of grieving families for whom the coverage of this and us even having this conversation is painful. Can you talk about the sensitivity that you had to bring to your reporting on something like this?
These families have been through, you know, the first of these cases was in 2015. Having it is so important. And the fact that these questions now rock any sort of sense of closure they were able to have, I think has been devastating, as anyone can understand.
These murders coincided with a spike in infant mortality in Britain. Austerity measures have left hospitals short-staffed. Maternal outcomes are now worse in Britain than in much of Europe. Tell me about the systemic problems that are the backdrop.
So what we found in our reporting through a number of leaked documents from the Countess of Chester Hospital, where all of this happened, was that it was really struggling. It was facing a number of really serious challenges. Staff were understaffed and underskilled. There was also an issue with the transport service. So these hospitals operate in a network where really sick babies will be transferred to a hospital that can deal with more complex issues. And there were serious issues with that service, that it wasn't available when they needed it. And then there was a bacteria outbreak in a ward. It's called Pseudomonas, and it's not that harmful to healthy people, but for in an ICU, and especially a neonatal ICU, it can be really dangerous. We couldn't directly link any of these issues to the deaths or the collapses that happened that were the subject of this trial, but they certainly created a picture of a unit that wasn't operating at its best.
So UK law differs from the US when it comes to reporting on litigation that's ongoing, but some of the reporting on Letby has been censored in this country. There was a story in the New Yorker magazine that wasn't allowed to be published in the UK. And so when it was published online, friends here were sharing PDFs because the website was blocked in the UK. Tell me about how those legal restrictions have complicated your own reporting.
The reason for that is the UK has really strong contempt of court laws. The media is only allowed to report what happens on a day-to-day basis in that trial, and people aren't allowed to speculate about guilt or innocence or what the outcome of the trial might be. It was really hard to get people to speak, even off the record, which was, or, you know, a private phone call, which is perfectly legal. People were really reluctant because they were scared.
In America, there's been a series, an obsession with missing girl cases, and the victims are frequently young, white women. Lucy Letby is a young, white woman. Has race and gender affected the way this case has either been prosecuted or the media coverage of it?
There is a fascination, I think, with women murderers. Mm-hmm. So gender, definitely. There is also a fascination with women who can harm children. So I think it's the nature of the crimes, really. But over the course of the trial, very little was exposed about who this woman is beyond painting a picture of someone who is just very ordinary. So often in these cases where women harm children, there is a history of psychiatric disorder. There was nothing like that in Lucy Letby's history. Also, she was well liked on the ward. She was thought to be a competent nurse. The judge even said that in his sentencing remarks. Like I said, she was nothing but, if not ordinary. Mm-hmm. And I think that did create a kind of fascination with who she was and why these crimes occurred.
That's BBC correspondent Stephanie Hegarty. Her podcast is called Lucy Letby, The Killer Questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seth Meyers has a new HBO stand-up special called Dad Man Walking. As host of Late Night on NBC, Meyers usually talks about news and current events. But in this stand-up, he focuses instead on his family and his personal life. He told my colleague Rachel Martin that given the sensitive subject matter, he'll sometimes vet his jokes with his wife ahead of time.
There's a great responsibility to the freedom she gives me to go out on stage and talk about it. Yeah. And I think if anybody watches the special and you said to them, now, based on what you've heard, who's the dumbest person in the family? Everybody would say me.
Seth Meyers looked back on his youth and his time at Saturday Night Live on NPR's Wildcard podcast, the show where famous guests answer big questions about their life drawn from a deck of cards. Here's Rachel.
1, 2, 3.
One. Yeah.
When have you felt most homesick?
When have I felt most homesick? I've never felt that homesick.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
You are close with your parents, though.
I'm close with my parents, and I think one of the reasons I've never felt homesick is because my parents still live in the house I grew up in.
Wow.
One of the reasons I don't feel particularly homesick for that is I am my parents have an old English sheepdog, and they have had different ones over the course of the entirety of my life. And I'm definitely allergic to them. And when I thought I was chronically ill all through high school, and then I went to college.
You're like, it's an autoimmune disease.
Yep. And then I went to college, and I'm like, nope, it was the dog. We even went. I was telling this story recently. Because my dad is one of those people who will not accept. He was very frustrated with how sick I got, and he thought there had to be a root cause. And so I remember we went to one of those allergy doctors where they do the prick
test. Oh, my God, I had that done on my back. Yeah, it's hard.
And so, you know, your whole arm, and you know, I remember just driving there, my dad being like, we're going to figure this out. We're going to make you better. Nobody should be as sick as you. Oh. And then they did the prick test, and the biggest spot was dogs. And then we got in the car, he's like, we're not getting rid of the dog. And so... So I'm not home. And again, I'm, you
take
know.
Take a couple Benadryl, you'll be fine.
Exactly.
One, two, three.
Three.
Three. Has ambition ever led you astray?
Has ambition ever led me astray? I'm not astray. I think that sometimes ambition maybe led me away from my strengths. You know, being on SNL, obviously there were a lot of people that I was colleagues with who both were on SNL and they were having robust acting careers outside of SNL. And I was covetous of that. And I mean, I guess it's ambition. I was like, oh, I want to be in movies too. And I'm very, you know, slowly it dawned on me, and it probably should have dawned on me faster. Oh, this isn't the thing I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm good at some other things, mm-hmm. but being an actor isn't one of them. And when I look back, I'm like, oh, I wasted a lot of time and put myself through a ringer that I could have avoided if I had just had the sense of, like, you know what? Sometimes ambition for a thing is misplaced if you don't actually have the sort of underlying talent that you need to go along with it.
But you came to that realization on your own. It didn't take someone telling you part's not going to work out.
I mean, I should say, like, I kept not getting cast. So it wasn't like anybody ever took me aside. It's not like your agents are like, stop. They're still But I did at some point say, I don't want to go on auditions anymore. And I think I'm just going to. And at the time, you know, some other things happened that. Being promoted to head writer at SNL I realized, oh, this is an accomplishment and it should be enough for me, and I should maybe let go of that other chase.
But that's a harder, I would imagine, head writer at SNL. Like, what's that career trajectory? Like, it worked out for you.
Sure.
But when you're an actor, you're just like, I'm an actor, and then
But weirdly, I guess one of the things was I wasn't as much of an actor as other people in the cast. I had been an improv comedian, and then I, you know, had this weird path that led me to SNL. And then you make this mistake of you walk down a hallway and you see pictures of former cast members, and you think because you work at the same place they do, you're going to have the same career path, you know? But it's a mistake to say just because you got hired at the same place as Adam Sandler or Will Ferrell, that doesn't mean you're going to have their career. And a lot of different people with a lot of different skill sets come through SNL. And so, you know, I'm very grateful that there was a patience with my time there that allowed me to find my fit.
Yeah. One, two, three.
Three.
Are you good at knowing when something should end?
Yes.
Relationships?
Uh-huh.
Conversations?
Conversations, definitely.
You're good at conversations?
Yeah.
Ending them?
Yes.
Disagreements?
Yes, I'm very good. I hope I don't get in trouble for this. My wife and my sister-in-law were fighting once, And I walked out. It was like during a very fraught Christmas vacation. It was like we were all, too many people were in my in-laws' house.
This is a classic recipe.
Yeah, just too many.
Yes. Young
children,
holidays.
Everybody, and they were fighting in the hallway. And I came out and I screamed, you know, some people de-escalate. And they were both very taken aback. But I disagree.
It's easier to end someone else's debate.
I'm very
fight.
Good. I know when to walk away from an argument. Mm. I think I'm really good at that way. I think part of it is I'm more often than not willing to take the L.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
I think I'm happy to take the L in a disagreement for the purposes of moving on. And, you know, another thing, I feel like I was in, I think this is true of a lot of people, I was a far more temperamental when I was younger. And things ran very hot at SNL. And there were definitely times where my instincts were to say something that would have been relationship ending to people.
Oh, really?
You know, just you're having an argument and, you know, looking back, all shamefully petty, you know.
But you didn't say those things, or did
no,
you?
No, and one of the reasons I didn't say them is because my producer and dear friend Mike Shoemaker, who works with me now, works with me on SNL, I remember once saying what, you know, I'm going to go tell so-and-so, he's a you-know-what. And he used to always say, it's a long life. It's a long life. And the people you work with here, what you are going through with them is going to, even for the ones that aren't your favorite people, this is bonding. And you will need... For the rest of your life, you will need these relationships to remember what this time was like. Mm-hmm. And these people, more of them are going to be at your wedding that aren't. And so I'm very happy I lived by the adage of it's a long life. Because if it's somebody you think might be your friend in the future, there's no reason to burn it down in the present.
The new special is called Dad Man Walking. You can see it on HBO Max. It's very funny. It's worth your time. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can hear the rest of that conversation with Seth Meyers by following the Wildcard podcast. And that's All Things Considered for Sunday. I'm Lauren Freyer.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU in KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH in KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV in KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. K210 Sierra Atchison, 89.9. And K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday afternoon. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Cherry Street Youth, an after-school program for students in Chanute. Now in a fundraising challenge to support the program, with a 100% match, doubling donations through the end of the year. Contributions welcome at cherrystreet.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy, a low of 57 degrees. For tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy, and highs in the mid-80s. For tomorrow night, clear, breezy, and a low of 69. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Parents, here is all the evidence that you need that TV is bad for kids, especially public TV. When Sean was 14, he loved watching those British TV shows they're always running on PBS, Masterpiece Theater, Doctor Who.
And then there was this show that I would stay up really late and watch and tape and watch over and over again. The tape's called Dempsey and Makepeace, which was about an American detective who went to London because he had been like set up at home, and he was teamed up with a woman who was this aristocrat named Lady Harriet Makepeace. And I was really on her side. I thought, you know, she's got it going on.
You looked down on the Americans.
Oh yeah.
What Sean liked about Lady Harriet Makepeace and all the other Brits on TV was their aloofness, how they seemed above it all, how they looked down on Americans. Which Sean did also. Convinced there must be something wrong with the nation that produced jocks and bullies who harassed him in school. And sometimes, joking around with his friends, he would talk with a British accent.
And then it was just something that spiraled out of control. I know that eventually I was just using an English accent literally from waking to sleeping, morning, noon, and night.
Sean spoke with a British accent from the time he was 14 until he was 16. And at some point, his mom thought, you know, maybe I need to do something about this, and took him to see a psychiatrist.
He was just really, I don't know the different schools of psychology, but he was really very confrontive. And he was like, well, you know, you've got to stop doing this, he said, because you're not British, you know. And my mom just sort of sat over next to me, and she sort of went, yeah, to agree with him and, you know, to, you know, sort of help him in showing me this.
Sean was furious. He had an impulse to lecture the guy on how, in fact, he was British. And the only problem with that was that, A, he knew very well that he was not, and B, his mom was sitting right there. She was sure to contradict him. He didn't know what to do. The situation seemed impossible.
Because that's what I was thinking. Like, there has to be a way that I can be British still.
There must be a way that this is true somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
But today on our radio program, stories of people who tell a lie, and they get to the point where they believe the lie more than anybody else does. It feels like it must be true. Happens all the time. And can I say, we are not even going to get into what happens with political figures in this show, kidding themselves about the facts of things. Today we have stories of civilians, people like you and me, basically pulling hoaxes on ourselves. From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Stay with us.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for This American Life here on a Sunday evening. Listening to KPR is easy with an Amazon smart speaker. First, tell your device to enable the KPR skill. Then, whenever you say play KPR, you can not only live stream KPR 1 or KPR 2, but also listen to shows on demand, including the Retro Cocktail Hour and local news. Find out more by clicking the Extras tab at kansaspublicradio.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy skies, a low of 57 degrees. Sunny for Monday and breezy with highs in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night clear with a low of 69 and a high of 82 on Tuesday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
It's This American Life, Act 1. The sun never sets in the Moosewood Restaurant. So this is the story of two young people who, for a period in their lives, in their search to figure out who they were, pretended to be people who they were not. We're going to hear from Sean Cole and from Joel Lovell. We're going to start with Sean. Today's show is a rerun. This was recorded years ago. These days, Sean is a producer here at our show. Sean grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, a town that was approximately 3,350 miles from London.
It was second nature. It was first nature. It was, you know, to this day, I have trouble saying, oh, I faked an accent for 2 years. I mean, I had an accent for 2 years. I like.
Sean, could I just ask you to take a deep breath and describe for me what you had for lunch today, or perhaps for breakfast this morning, in as close to the accent that you can
muster. As close as I can?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to take a sip of water here. Well, Ira, I had a salad. I had it at the Boston House of Pancakes. Or pizza, rather.
What was the beverage?
It was a Snapple. A just lemon-flavoured. I don't really like the peach.
Joe Lovell's story began when he left the working-class town where he grew up, in upstate New York. His parents owned a liquor store in a small town. He was the first member of his family to go to college, and it was an especially big deal because he got into an Ivy League school, Cornell.
It was one of those first days of college, you know, when you spend a lot of time. Everybody kind of moves in hordes, and you spend a lot of time in each other's dorm rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about, 10 or 11 of us in this one guy's room. And we were just like sitting around eating pizza, and people were talking about what their, you know, where they were from and what their parents did and stuff like that. And there was one guy whose dad was a doctor for the Knicks. There was another guy whose father was an elected representative from New York State. And then this other guy whose father was on the World Court. Literally was a member of the World Court.
Oh, my.
And so it suddenly seemed like this incredibly sort of impressive group to me. And they seemed like just sort of worldly in ways that, you know, it was just beyond my wildest imagination. And you know, worldly beyond, you know, what I am now, frankly. and I remember sort of sitting there at the time thinking, oh, my God, I'm so out of my league here. And then completely unplanned, I suddenly said... As a slice of pizza was passed to me, this sort of pizza with sausage on top of it, I said, I can't take that because my parents are vegetarians. And everybody in the room kind of sort of turned and looked at me because it wasn't even as if I said, well, you know, I'm a vegetarian. But I said, you know, my parents are vegetarians. And there's a sort of puzzled look on everybody in the room. And I said, well, you know, and I am too. I've never eaten meat. And I'm not entirely, well, I mean, I have some ideas now about why I said that, but at the time I had no idea what I was saying. It was like, you know, suddenly I'd become possessed and I had to think of something to say about myself that seemed interesting. And vegetarianism was the thing that I chose.
Now, did you tell people that you were actually from England?
No, never that I was from Britain, but in a way... that I was British, you know, there was a real distinction there for me. Like I'd taken it on. Like I was culturally British now.
Well, I think what it was is, I think I did some sort of calculus that took like a nanosecond in my head. And I thought, you know, I can't actually lie about what my parents do. But I think the connections that I was making were this, that somehow, like, because I was from this town in the sticks, if my folks were vegetarians, then the whole history that suggested was that they were sort of these, these kind of leftist academic radicals who had sort of dropped out of society and gone back to the land. And I was living in this bumpkin town in upstate New York, and you know my folks were living some sort of life that was driven by their political philosophy rather than, you know, I was just a guy who grew up in upstate New York.
You know, I did the old kid thing of, like, wishing that my real British parents would come and tell me I was adopted and take me back to London.
So I'm sitting there in the room, and all these guys are looking at me. And they're like, dude, you know, then you know, what do you eat? And suddenly I realized in that moment how little I knew about vegetarianism. And I tried to be real sort of vague about it. You know, we eat salads and lentils. I remember sort of saying lentils a lot.
You know, and there was a gap. Certainly in my education, because like I would be using, you know, words that Americans just don't use. You know, I would, instead of saying drugstore, I would say chemist, or, you know, I would try my best to remember to say, you know, bonnet instead of hood or boot instead of trunk, but I often couldn't.
On the meal plan, I ended up eating a lot of big piles of iceberg lettuce and chickpeas.
And during that time, would you find yourself sneaking to go to get meat somewhere?
Yeah, definitely. At first, I would go really far from campus in order to have like a BLT. There was this there's this diner downtown in Ithaca, and it was, you know, it felt incredibly illicit. I'd be sitting there and I'd have some reading material or something with me, and I'd be the lonely guy in my booth.
And I would order the BLT, and I would sort of watch it kind of coming from across the room, you know, with its toothpick in the top of it. And a side of French fries with this meat gravy on top. And it would just, you know, when it landed on the table, it would just seem like this incredibly, you know, sort of wonderful moment, you know, when you're doing something just totally unlike what anybody would expect of you.
I was nobody, you know. I mean, I was living in an extremely small kind of rural town in the middle of nowhere. It was, I guess, in a way, like this was my way of traveling, you know, in a way, and of being somebody, and sort of achieving an identity, which I guess I didn't feel like I had. Like, I didn't feel like I'm just sort of realizing this now. But I guess I didn't feel as though I had anything that made me up.
I mean, what I realized fairly quickly is that if this is going to be believable, I actually have to, I have to believe in it. But I also began to not only believe, but really sort of take on as my persona all of the stuff that I imagined was associated with vegetarianism. So,
like what?
Well, you know, certain political convictions and ways of dress.
I wore ripped jeans and I wore combat boots, but I also wore like a kind of stage jacket that you would see, you know, in a community theater production of Hamlet.
Yeah, you know, I bought sandals. I very specifically remember going down to this thrift store in downtown Ithaca and buying a pair of fatigue shorts, which just seemed like, you know, I might as well have been Che Guevara at that point. That's funny. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was a dangerous leftist.
Did you at any point during this find yourself in the following argument? Well, you would say, I've never had a hamburger, and somebody would insist, oh, you must have had meat at some point. And then you had to argue your side?
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't pretty. And of course, you know, I had grown up. I mean, just to put this in context for a second, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only had I had hundreds of hamburgers and gone to the McDonald's drive-thru hundreds of times, but the counterpoint situation that I always think about when I remember this time is that when I was a senior in high school, my family, for sort of time-saving reasons, decided that a great thing to do would be to go to Arby's Roast Beef. I don't know if you have those out in Chicago. I think they're countrywide. So my dad and I would go to Arby's on, say, like a, you know, Thursday afternoon or something, or after I got out of school. And we would go in there and we would buy 48 Arby's Roast Beef sandwiches. They would put them in this cardboard box, and we would bring home this giant box full of those tinfoil covered Arby's roast beef sandwiches, and we would stuff them in our refrigerator, in our freezer. We would freeze the Arby's roast beef sandwiches, and then we would have them there.
Buns, you know, and all?
Buns and all, yeah. And so we would have them there as ready-made snacks whenever we might want one. I mean, that's the kind of meat eating that my family was engaged in.
The other thing was that I had these run-ins with doubting my British identity, like...
Oh, really?
Yeah, as though it were slipping away. And I would really go nuts at that point. And, you know, there was one time it would happen at home. I was, like, at home, and I was like, oh, my God, I just, you know, I have to do something. I have to affirm my devotion, you know. So I think I opened up the window and... I psyched myself to do it. I was like, oh man, if I don't do this, like, it won't come back. And I opened up the window and then I screamed. This is the middle of the night, or, you know, 10 at night. I screamed, I love England, like, outside the, and of course in a British accent, outside the window.
And then you felt better? You felt like you had reasserted yourself?
I felt like I had done something at least.
For England.
Yeah, I had fortified my Britishness.
I would find myself in these conversations where people were saying, you know, you've never had a McDonald's hamburger? What kind of American, 18-year-old American, has never had a hamburger from McDonald's?
Quite a legitimate question, I would add.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would say, yeah, you know, I've just never had one. They scare me. And I would sort of like talk about the ways, you know, and then I would make up these stories about how I'd come close a couple of times, how a friend of mine in high school had bought me a Big Mac, and there I was sitting on the front seat of his car, and I almost ate it and then couldn't bring myself to do it. And so, yeah, there was all the sort of drama that I lied about. My mom and dad came down to visit for parents' weekend, and they were really proud that I was going there and really excited to come down. And they came down to visit.
And really proud because you were the first generation to go to college. You made it into this Ivy League school. It was a big, big deal.
Right, exactly. And so they drove down from Camillus, which is about, you know, between an hour and an hour and a half, they came down. And, you know, in that week leading up to Parents Weekend, everybody's talking about their parents coming and everybody's making reservations at restaurants, you know, where to eat on Saturday night. And everybody's sort of planning on taking their parents to the football game on, you know, Saturday during the day. And it suddenly occurred to me, this real sort of panic set in that, you know, that my parents would come down and we would go to a football game and my dad would buy a hot dog. And, you know, and somebody like across the field would see Mr. Lovell eating a hot dog, and, you know, and then of course the cat would be out of the bag. And so I thought, you know, I've got to make a reservation at a restaurant at some place, either A, where nobody else's parents will be, or at a vegetarian restaurant. And so what I did was make a reservation at the Moosewood restaurant, which is in Ithaca. And, you know, there's the Moosewood cookbooks that are out and
vegetarian cookbooks.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's this nice little vegetarian restaurant in Ithaca and a slightly famous place. But then we got there and, you know, and it just, I remember sitting down at the table in the Moosewood and, you know, the bowls are these kind of carved wooden bowls. And, I mean, everything about it feels like, well, like a vegetarian restaurant.
And not just a vegetarian restaurant, but kind of a cartoon of a vegetarian restaurant.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and I was looking at my parents across the table and they were sort of dressed up and they were excited to be coming down. And, you know, and I could tell like my dad was sitting there and sort of perusing the menu and thinking, well, you know, I'll, you know, maybe this lentil salad will be good or whatever. And I could tell he was sitting there thinking, you know, geez, I just drove an hour and a half. All I want is a steak and a baked potato and a beer, you know? And there I was bringing them here. But they were so game about it. They were sort of willing to go along with it because for some reason they thought I really wanted to bring them there. And I just thought, geez, you know, these people, my parents, you know, have really like given up a lot for me to come there. I mean, financially, they were really stretching themselves and we were taking out all sorts of loans, you know, all of those things that people do in order to go to college.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they never complained once about doing it. And they were, you know, they just wanted to come down and see me there and feel proud that I was there. And I was sort of hiding them out in this vegetarian restaurant. And I felt so bad about it afterwards. And they never once complained. And they went home, and I imagine I sort of imagine them, you know, stopping at a Hardee's just outside of Ithaca and getting a burger as soon as they say goodbye. But you know, after that, I just thought, geez, you know, I got to find some way to come clean about this.
I mean, is it okay if your child decides to express himself in an alternate personality for a period of 2 years?
I think there's... It's funny. I never thought I would say this, but I think there's nothing wrong with that. I never thought I would say it because I wish that I hadn't done it now. But, I don't know, maybe I learned something from doing it. I mean, I think that is, you know, par for the course. Like, that's part of... Now, I think that's part of growing up.
I think it was probably necessary for me at that time in my life.
Because it gave you more confidence.
Yeah. And there was some bridge that this you know, that this allowed me to cross.
Joe Lovell and Sean Cole,
Joel Lovell is the executive editor of a podcast company called Pineapple Street Media and an actual vegetarian these days.
Sean Cole works in public radio.
Indeed he does. He's one of the producers of our program.
That piece of meat on your plate, buying was murder, eating is right. Think about your act makes me feel under the weather. Bet you wouldn't care if it came out in feathers. Bet you wouldn't care if it came out in feathers. You're such a psycho.
Act two, conning the con men. The American legal system, for the most part, does not uphold the principle of eye for an eye. If you steal somebody's car, the judge does not steal your car in return. If they catch you selling weed, they do not sell weed to you as your punishment. But if you're in the business of running scams, authorities catch you by running a scam on you. This is the story of a con man who made millions by fooling people over the phone until he was the one who got fooled. Nancy Updike reports.
The guy's name is David Diamond. That's his actual name. He was one of the most successful salesmen in one of the longest-running telemarketing scams in Los Angeles history.
David Diamond was a salesman at a boiler room.
This is Dale Sokovich. He's been a Federal Trade Commission investigator for 29 years. He's the one who busted Diamond.
He was living in a very expensive home up in the hills in Woodland Hills. He drove a custom Porsche Carrera that he had shipped over here by airplane from Germany, from the factory. They lived very high on the hog.
David Diamond was just one of a whole bunch of guys making money hand over fist in an operation in Southern California that was basically running the same scam over and over under different names for 7 years. It was an investment scheme. Give us your money and we'll put it into this great 900 number business, or this online shopping network, or this hot new internet service provider. Needless to say, no one ever made a dime, except the people running the scam, who cleared $40 million. Since Diamond was one of the operation's top salesmen, he made $2 million in commissions in just 4 years on the job. He got 30% of whatever he talked a person into investing. That means he personally conned people out of more than $6 million. The FTC caught Diamond and the others in the operation essentially by conning the con men. They had volunteers pose as dupes and record their phone calls. Because the FTC brought a case against the operation Diamond worked in, some of those recordings are now part of the public record. I got Dale Sokovich to listen to the tapes with me and talk about David Diamond and the FBI volunteer who caught him.
The woman on the tape, I can't tell you her real name, but she uses the alias of Marge. She assumed the identity of a person who is named Marge. Marge was a real person who we in law enforcement and who people in the telemarketing business refer to as a mooch. A mooch is someone who will essentially buy anything from anybody who calls her on the telephone. And in fact, she did over a number of years. She spent hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The real Marge.
The real Marge spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on bogus prize promotions, investments, gold coins, you name it. So the FBI went to Marge and said, we really think that we need to take your telephone number away from you because it's being used to ruin your life. So once Marge agreed to that, her telephone number was installed in the home of an FBI volunteer. And that volunteer, every time that phone line rang, the Marge line, that volunteer would pick up that telephone and answer it and pose as Marge.
Marge?
Yes.
It's David Diamond. How are you?
Oh, I'm okay. It's kind of warm here.
Yeah? I sent you off a video and a package.
Yes, I have it.
Okay. The video is with regard to Mark Erickson.
Uh-huh.
Mark Erickson is the person who is heading up the program.
Yes.
And he is very successful in taking upstart companies and making them successful. You've probably heard of Hard Copy. He's the original producer of Hard Copy.
I've heard of it, yes.
Okay. You're smiling as you listen to this. What are you smiling about?
Well, I'm smiling because it's been a while since I've heard Marge, and she sounds so old and so fragile and such an easy mark. When in fact, you know, she's this sharp FBI informant, and she doesn't look as old as she sounds, trust me. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is this whole Mark Erickson thing.
Yeah, is he a real person?
Mark Erickson is a real person. He was named in our lawsuit.
And was he an original producer of Hard Copy?
No. He was a segment producer and on-the-air reporter for Hard Copy for a brief period of time.
And, I mean, is this sort of typical of the cons in the tapes that you've heard that they'll try to associate what they're selling with a legitimate or organization
exactly.
or television show, something that people have heard of?
Exactly. They want to make this, something people can relate to.
Here's the thing. You have to invest everything you've got or do nothing at all. And I'll say that again. You should invest everything you have. You should transfer all of your investments into this program or do nothing. It doesn't make sense to do just a little bit. You should think about doing $1 million in this program.
I don't know. That's a lot of money.
You need to liquidate every nickel you've got. You either want to be in the situation, you either want to be in the situation wholeheartedly, and upgrade your investments, or you don't. My suggestion is just do the whole thing.
Well, I would never liquidate everything I have.
My question is, why not?
Because there's always gambles in anything like this.
Anything like what?
Well, any investment like this.
Like this? What does that mean?
Well, anything you invest in, there's always a gamble.
Now, I want to ask you, you told me once that you thought he sounded nervous on this tape. And in this part where she's saying, you know, an investment like this, and he's sort of, you know, questioning her, well, what do you mean like this? I wonder, do you have any sense that he's suspicious that she might know what he's up to? I mean, do they know that volunteers are out there trying to trap them, posing as dupes?
No. Since we talked about this tape last, actually, sort of had a revelation that came to me as to why. I listened to over 40 individual tapes of David Diamond, conversations with Marge and conversations with others over the course of about a year. And one of the things, when you've listened to all of them, you find that David, in sort of the earlier part of that year, was much more kind of sweet and cautious and trying to bond with these women and patient, and sometimes would spend an hour on the phone with them. The tape would be an hour long. But this tape was made towards the very end of that year period, probably within a week or two of our raid. Having gone in on the raid and searched David Diamond's desk that day, I came to realize that David Diamond was starting to question whether he wanted to do this anymore. He was starting to really have some concerns about
moral concerns
about what they were doing. And I believe that in these last couple of weeks, and it's kind of shown in this tape, he was becoming a little bit desperate. He wanted to make a couple of more big hits, and he just couldn't figure out why this woman wasn't going to write him a check. So he started getting frustrated, and it comes out in his voice.
What evidence did you see that he was starting to have, you know, moral qualms about what he was doing?
David had become born again. There were religious tracts all over his office and posters on his wall.
Just recently?
I don't know exactly what the time frame was. We do know that he had given a lot of the money that he had made to his church. And we believe that a lot of that was sort of a self-imposed penance, that he could justify what he was doing because he was giving, was tithing this this money that he was taking from these poor victims into his church.
If $30,000 is what you made on every $5,000, and you put $50,000 in this program, that's $300,000 returned.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm telling you, you need to do $1 million in this program.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would never put that much in any program.
Do you have an obligation to yourself as an investor to make the most amount of money possible?
Well, you know, at my age, it's really not that, what do I want to say? I have enough to live on for the rest of my life.
I understand. But is it still in your best interest to make the most amount of money possible if you can find to do it as safely as possible?
It's my obligation not to lose what I have.
Correct. But it's also your obligation to keep your money working for you.
Right.
Well, otherwise,
right.
What's the point?
When I heard this part of the tape, even though I knew that that this woman, this particular woman, was not getting conned, that she was in fact conning him and trapping him, I started to get so angry because I was thinking, you know, he is really trying to take all of this old woman's money, all of it. She's saying, I have enough to live on. He's saying, you have an obligation to make more. Do you ever hear things like that and just get angry, even though you know that she's sort of in on the con, on the joke?
Every time I hear these pitches, I'm outraged. because I am the person that spoke to people who really did send David Diamond tens of thousands of dollars that consisted of their life savings, and now don't have any money to even buy groceries. I've interviewed them. I've seen them sob. It makes me very angry.
And what sort of recourse do they have?
Slim and none.
We have public companies that want to take you public.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a public company that's passed judgment on, it's not even me talking anymore. If Mark Erickson wants to do business with you, it's not even me talking anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You have the ability to make an absolute fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense not to have every nickel you've got in this particular program. That's why I said it's an emergency investment situation, and you should do at least 50 to 100, 150 units while you have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much are you investing in this?
I'm not investing anything in this.
Uh-huh.
My investment comes in the time that I put with my clients.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that when they make money, they reinvest with me.
Right. Uh-huh.
That's the whole point.
Uh-huh.
You were smiling again. When she said, you know, how much are you investing? I mean, is she just screwing around with him?
Of course she's playing with him. Yeah. I mean, she's trained to ask him those kinds of questions so that he responds with a misrepresentation.
But that doesn't sound like it's part of the script. That just sounds like her being mean in sort of a delicious way.
Well, no, I think what we were trying to do, or her handler was trying to do, was get her to get him to say, oh yeah, I'm in it, and I've got my mother and my grandmother in it, and I'm putting away money for my child's education with it. Because then we could show later that he hadn't.
Did you ever talk to Marge about what it's like to do this? Do they ever sort of have fun just thinking, you know, I'm just turning the tables on this guy. He has no idea.
I can't. I wish I could answer the question. I've never spoken to them. I'd love to get the answer to that myself. I'd like to ask that question myself. I think they get a lot of personal satisfaction, though.
How often do you get a chance to catch a bad guy as just a regular civilian?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I do it too. I tape people using an alias in cases that I work.
And is it fun?
I love it. I love to get these people to tell me stuff. It's like acting. There's a rush.
Thank you.
The rush of a con, the pleasure of it, is knowing that you have more power than the person you're conning. You know more. You know that it's a con. And let's face it, given the choice between being the mark and being the con man, nobody's going to choose to be the mark. But the problem is, the more confidence you have in your own con, the more easily you become a mark yourself. Con men get taken by other con men all the time. There just seems to be something about the particular arrogance of always being on the knowing side of the con that makes for a really, really good mark.
Nancy Updike is one of the producers of our program. In the years since we first broadcast this episode, today's show is a rerun. Dale Sekovich, the FTC investigator who busted David Diamond, has died. Coming up, a child tries to fix his own family by harnessing the most powerful force that exists anywhere. That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio when our program continues.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for This American Life here on a Sunday evening. Just in time for Halloween, the haunted states of America. Coming up on KPR Presents, it's a cross-country trip of spooky stories. We'll visit with William Mockry and Giselle Anatole about their contributions to this anthology for middle school readers. Also on this week's program, what role will split-ticket voters play in the upcoming election? It's part two of Beyond the Ballot from the Dole Institute of Politics. That's on KPR Presents, just ahead at 6 p.m., here on Kansas Public Radio. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy, a low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the mid-80s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This American Life from Ira Glass. Each week in our program, of course, we choose a theme, bring you a variety of different kinds of stories on that theme. Today's show, Hoaxing Yourself. Stories of people who are fooling themselves. Sometimes that is a side effect of trying to fool others. Sometimes they just don't know better and pin their hopes and beliefs on something that is simply not true at all. We've arrived at Act 3 of our show, Act 3, Oedipus Hex. Shalom Auslander tells a story which happened to him when he was a boy in one of those ultra-Orthodox Jewish religious schools called yeshivas. I wanted to listeners that although this story is about a little boy, in the story the dad is not so nice to his kids, which might not be a thing that little kids will enjoy hearing at all. So take that under advisement. Here's Shalom.
Rabbi Breyer walked into our third grade classroom, hung up his long black coat, took off his big black hat, and handed each student a small black booklet entitled The Guide to Blessings. We had 1 week, he told us, to prepare for the annual Yeshiva of Spring Valley Blessing Bee. My heart leapt. This was just what my mother needed. The Blessing Bee would make her forget all the troubles of our home. To have a son who's a Talmud Chacham, a wise student, that was the ultimate. Her brother was a respected rabbi, and if her husband couldn't be one, well, maybe her son could be. The Guide to Blessings was a 70-page long listing of hundreds of different foods, soups, breads, fish, desserts. I flipped through it, slowly realizing the size of the challenge that lay ahead. Falafel, herring, eggplant parmesan. I had my work cut out for me. Friday afternoons, the yeshiva closed early so that we could all rush home to help our parents prepare for Shabbos, the Sabbath. Rabbi Breyer told us that the sages tell us that the Torah tells us that the preparation for Shabbos is equal to the importance of Shabbos itself. Most of my preparations involved searching the house for kosher wine and pouring it down the toilet. It was a thankless job, I admitted to nobody. My father's frustrated rage at not having his Manischewitz Concord grape was fearsome, but it was far better than his drunken rage if he did have it. I'd search the pantry, I'd search the garage, I'd search my father's closet, but I was only 8 years old, and there was always a bottle of Kedem hiding somewhere I just hadn't thought to check. That night, my father, drunk on a bottle of Blush Chablis that got away, grabbed my older brother by his shirt collar and dragged him away from the Shabbos table. He dragged him all the way down the stairs to our bedroom in the basement and slammed the door shut. Even the silverware jumped. "Who wants the last matzo ball?" my mother asked. "I made extra." When my brother returned to the table, his nose was bleeding. My mother brought him a can of frozen orange juice to hold against the back of his neck, which was supposed to somehow stop the bleeding. Rabbi Breyer taught us that it is prohibited to defrost orange juice on Shabbos because changing food from solid to liquid is considered cooking, and cooking is considered working, and even God refrained from working on Shabbos. There are 39 different categories of work that are prohibited on Shabbos. That's also why you're not allowed to switch on lights on Shabbos. The electricity causes the filament to glow, which is considered burning, which is considered working. Category number 2. My father came back to the table and drunkenly sang a few Shabbos songs, fudging the words and banging heavily on the table with his fist. I sat hunched over, absent-mindedly drawing circles on the condensation that had formed on the silver water pitcher. My father slapped my hand. "Shabbos!" he shouted. Writing, category number 5. Eventually, he stumbled off to his bedroom and fell asleep, snoring loudly. We sat in the dining room and picked glumly at our food. The following Monday morning, as we all sat studying from our blessing books, there was a knock on Rabbi Breyer's classroom door, and Rabbi Greenbaum, the yeshiva principal, solemnly entered. We all rose. The two rabbis conferred quietly for a moment before signaling us all to be seated. After a few thoughtful strokes of his long black beard, Rabbi Greenbaum sighed deeply and informed us that the night before, our classmate Avrami Grunenbaum's father had suffered a heart attack and died. Some kids have all the luck. "Blessed is the one true judge," said Rabbi Breyer, nodding his head. "Blessed is the one true judge," we all answered, nodding our heads. I wondered what Mr. Grunenbaum might have done to deserve death. Did he bow down to idols? Did he walk 4 steps without his yarmulke on? Whatever it was, it must have been pretty bad. As Rabbi Greenbaum turned to leave, he paused, and with a stern shake of his finger, reminded us all that the sages tell us, that the Torah tells us, that until the age of 13, all of a boy's sins are ascribed to his father. I turned to look at Avrami's empty chair. Avrami was a chubby kid with heavy orthodontia and foul breath, but a sudden respect for him grew inside me. I wondered what he might have done to cause his father's death. Whatever it was, it must have been pretty bad. Scowling fiercely, Rabbi Greenbaum advised each and every one of us to pray to Hashem, the Holy One, blessed be He, for forgiveness, so that He wouldn't kill our fathers too. My heart leapt. "Blessed is Hashem," he said. "Blessed is Hashem," we answered. "Blessed is Hashem" was right. All of a sudden, I had 2 ways I could save my family. I could win the blessing be for my mother, or I could sin so much, Hashem would have to kill my father. Courageous Avrami Grunenbaum. Maybe one Shabbos night he had switched on a light. Maybe he drank milk after eating meat. Maybe he touched himself. That night, just before bed, I ate a drumstick, washed it down with some milk, touched myself, and flicked the bedroom light on and off. "Break those lights and I'll break your hands," my father shouted. It was going to be a busy week. The blessing bee worked the same way as a spelling bee. There are 6 basic blessings on food. Hamotzi, the blessing for bread. Mizonos, the blessing for wheat. Hagefen, the blessing for wine or grape juice. Haetz, the blessing for things that grow from trees. Hadama, the blessing for things that grow from the earth. And Shehakol, the blessing for everything else. Bagel, hamotzi. Oatmeal, mizonos. Gefilte fish, Shehakol, the blessing for everything else. But that was the easy part. Things became much more complicated when you started combining foods. Some foods are superior to other foods, and in combination with subordinate foods, the superior food gets the blessing. To make matters worse, some blessings are superior to other blessings, and you had to know which blessing to recite first. This is where they separated the men from the goys. Spaghetti and meatballs, Mizonos, the wheat blessing, then Shahako, the everything else blessing. Cereal with milk, Shahako for the milk, then Mizonos for the wheat and the cereal. Twix, the chocolate candy with the cookie crunch. Trick question, Twix isn't kosher. I spent the next week sinning and blessing and sinning, alternately praising God and then defying him as much as 1 8-year-old possibly could. Monday morning, I stuffed myself. I had a bowl of Fruity Pebbles, Mizonos, a slice of toast, Hamotzi, a glass of juice, Shahako, half an apple, Ha'etz, and a couple of old French fries I found at the bottom of the fridge, Hadama. One meal, 5 blessings. Tuesday, I touched myself. I also partook of her ceremoniously washing my hands. And that evening, before going to sleep, I sat on the edge of my bed and carefully recited and ass 12 times each. My father banged angrily on my bedroom door. Lights out, he barked. I smiled. For you and me both, pal. Wednesday, I stole $5 from my mother and didn't recite any blessings at all on the bag full of candy that I bought with it. A Charleston Chew, which is trafe to begin with, and a Chunky, which would have been a Shahakol if I weren't trying to kill my father. A Chunky with raisins, Shahakol, then Ha'etz. Thursday, I didn't wear tzitzis. Rabbi Breyer noticed that the strings weren't dangling from my sides and grabbed me by the ear and pulled me to the front of the class. Speak to the children of Israel, he quoted loudly from the Torah as he spanked me hard on my bottom, and tell them to make tzitzis on the corners of their garments. That afternoon, after not respecting my elders by taking out the garbage like my mother had told me to, I touched myself and silently begged God to just this once credit those sins to Rabbi Breyer's account. Later, I defiled a prayer book by carrying it into the bathroom. The blessing bee was the following morning, and I could barely sleep. Lentil soup, Mizonos. Potato knish, Hadama. Root beer, is it a root? Is it a beer? Ass. I tossed and turned, I blessed and cursed, and finally I fell into an uncomfortable sleep. After a week at home, Avrami Grunenbaum conveniently returned to school just in time for the blessing bee. It was all I could do to not lean over and ask him how he did it. Psst, Avrami, tell me, was it lobster? Did you eat lobster? Rabbi Breyer told us that the sages tell us that the Torah tells us that when Abraham died, Hashem comforted Isaac. We learn from this that it is a tremendous mitzvah, or good deed, to comfort the bereaved. Rabbi Breyer instructed us all to line up at Avrami's desk, to shake his hand and recite the traditional mourner's consolation. May Hashem comfort you among the mourners of Zion. Being just 8 years old, I wasn't entirely familiar with Hashem's system, but it occurred to me that, along with all my sins, my father might also be getting all my mitzvahs. I wasn't taking any chances. Soon it was my turn in line. How's it going? I said to Avrami. Rabbi Breyer pinched me. Ow, I screamed. Shmendrick, he grumbled. After the last boy had asked Hashem to comfort Avrami among the mourners of Zion, Rabbi Breyer smacked his desk loudly. The blessing bee began. We lined up at the back of the classroom, nervously pulling on our tzitzis and twirling our payas. The rules were simple. Name the correct blessing and remain standing for the next round. Name the wrong blessing and you take your seat. Last year's winner, Yukasiel Zalman Yehuda Schneck, stood beside me. He leaned calmly against the wall, mindlessly picking his nose. Auslander, shalom, called out Rabbi Breyer. I stepped forward. Apple, he shouted. Apple, I called out. Ha'etz, the blessing for food from trees. Correct, Rabbi Breyer said. The blessing bee usually started off pretty easy. David Borden got tuna, Shahako, the everything else blessing. Ari Mashinsky got matzah, Hamotzi, the blessing for bread. And Avi Tuckman got stuck with kugel, which he thought was Hadama, food from the earth, but was really Mizonos, the blessing on wheat. 3 other kids got taken out by oatmeal. Borscht with Sour Cream claimed two others, and by the end of the first round, almost a third of the students were already back in their seats. Round two. Auslander, Shalom, called Rabbi Breyer. I stepped forward. Mushroom barley soup, he shouted. Mushroom barley soup, mushroom barley soup. Damn, I knew I should have studied the chapter on soups more. I'd wasted half the week on entrees. Was it Hadama on the mushrooms, which came from the earth? Or was it Mizonos on the barley? Maybe it was Shahakol, the everything else blessing on the soup. Mushroom barley soup, I called out. Mizonos. Rabbi Breyer tugged on his beard, his eyes narrowing into angry little slits. And, Shahakol, I added. Rabbi Breyer triumphantly smacked his desk, signaling that I was correct. Apple Strudel took out David Borgen, Yoel Levine, and Shlomo Pomerantz. My friend Mati Greenberg got stuck with cheesecake, and I could tell just by the expression on his face that he had absolutely no idea. He wisely offered two answers, one for thin crust and one for thick, and somehow managed to stay alive. It was hard to believe this was only round two. Avrami stepped forward. I smiled at Mati. Avrami may have killed his father, but he wasn't very bright, and he never did well at these things. He was lucky to even be in the second round at all. Bagel, shouted Rabbi Breyer. Bagel? I looked at Mati in disbelief. Was he kidding? Bagel? Bagel, called out Avrami. Hamotzi. This was bull. Correct, shouted Rabbi Breyer. Very good. Ephraim Greenblatt, Avrami Epstein, and Yoel Frankel all got out on chalent with barley and large pieces of meat, while chopped liver on challah with a slice of lettuce and a bit of olive took out four more, including Mati. And then there were three. It was just Yukasiel Zalman Yehuda Schneck, Avrami Grunenbaum, and me. Round three began. Auslander, Shalom, called out Rabbi Breyer. I stepped forward. Ice cream, shouted Rabbi Breyer. In a cone. Ice cream in a cone, ice cream in a cone. I knew ice cream, but why would he add the cone? Was there something different if it was in a cone? What was an ice cream cone made of anyway? Was it cake? Was it a wafer? Ice cream in a cone, Rabbi Breyer shouted. Is the ice cream subordinate to the cone, or is it the cone subordinate to the ice cream? If it's a sugar cone, maybe you really desire the cone. Ice cream in a cone, Rabbi Breyer shouted again. I had no choice. Ice cream in a cone, I called out. No blessing. Everyone in the classroom turned to face me. Looking back on the whole episode, Rabbi Breyer had really left me no choice. No blessing, said Rabbi Breyer. Why no blessing? Because, I explained, nervously twirling my tzitzis. Because. Because the room smells like duty. There was a long silence. Mati giggled, and others followed. Rabbi Breyer slowly rose to his feet, his thick fists pushing themselves into the desktop. It may have been a loophole, but technically speaking, I was correct. Rabbi Breyer himself had told us that our sages tell us that the Torah tells us that there are three situations in which one is absolutely prohibited from reciting a blessing. One, while facing a male over the age of 9 years old whose genitals are showing. Two, while facing a female over the age of 3 years old whose genitals are showing. And three, in the presence of feces. Frankly, given the other two options, I think I chose the least offensive answer. For a big man, Rabbi Breyer moved pretty quickly. It's true, I said as he barreled toward me. The Torah says that. He grabbed me roughly by my arm, lifting me clear off the ground, and dragged me towards the door, shouting angrily in Yiddish the whole time. But it smells like duty, I yelled. The room smells like duty. Wait, there's a naked girl in the room. There's a naked girl. The door slammed shut behind me. I stood in the hallway and rubbed my bruised arm. I began to cry. The blessing bee was lost. I was not a great rabbi. And my father was still not dead. I tiptoed toward the classroom door and listened closely. 2 minutes later, Yukasiel Zalman Yehuda Schneck fell victim to matzah brei with maple syrup, and the last man standing, was of Rummy Grunenbaum. Apples, called out Rabbi Breyer. Apples, Avrami answered. Ha'etz. Mazel tov, called out Rabbi Breyer. Mazel tov. Total bull. That night, we had the traditional Friday night gefilte fish, shahakol, with a little slice of carrot, hadama. My father was drunk again, singing Shabbos songs, fudging the words and banging heavily on the table with his fist. My mother went into the kitchen and brought out the soup. When my brother said he didn't want any, my father slapped him, pushed him over backward onto the floor, and poured the hot chicken soup onto his face. My mother took my brother into the bathroom and sat with him on the edge of the bathtub, pressing a cold washcloth against his cheeks, and I went back to the dining room to wipe the chicken soup off the floor. Chicken soup is a shahakol, even if it is cooked with vegetables, since chicken is the dominant taste in the soup. Rabbi Breyer told us that the sages tell us that the Torah tells us that the Holy One, blessed be He, sent the Egyptians 10 plagues in order to teach us that He gives people many chances to repent, and only then, if they still continue to sin, does He punish them with death. I went downstairs to my bedroom, took 4 steps without my yarmulke on, touched myself, flicked the lights off and on, and fell asleep.
Shalom Maslender. He's the author of many great books. The story appears in his memoir, Foreskin's Lament. His most recent book is called Feh, a memoir.
Well, I went and lost her to the great imposter. I stood and watched her fall.
Our program is produced today by me and Blue Cheveny, with Alex Bloomberg, Susan Burton, and Julie Snyder. Our contributing editors for today's show, Paul Tuff, Jack Hitt, Margie Rockin, Elise Spiegel, and Consigliere Sarah Val. Mixing help today by Jared Floyd and Catherine Raimondo. Production help on today's rerun from Matt Tierney and Henry Larson. This American Life is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Support for This American Life comes from Progressive Insurance. Snapshot from Progressive gives a personalized rate based on actual driving habits. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot is not available in California or from all agents. And from Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of your company in one simple and efficient business management platform. More information at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com. Thanks always to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia, who is not jealous at all. But the fact that This American Life staff get to tape interviews all the time.
You know, I do it too. I tape people using an alias.
I'm Eric Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
All her friends, they just watch her.
Watch her.
For they know the great imposter. And she's soon to join the roster. For they know the great imposter. And she's soon to join.
Support for This American Life on KPR comes from the Noto Arts and Entertainment District of Topeka, inviting listeners to the Dia de los Muertos Festival Friday, featuring the Celebration of Souls exhibit on loan from the Chicago Field Museum. Details at explorenoto.org. And the Lead Center, presenting a cappella group Straight No Chaser in their Top Shelf Tour, Wednesday, November 13th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Today on KPR Presents, it's Halloween season. The perfect time for a creepy cross-country tour with the haunted states of America. I'm Kay McIntyre. William Mockery of Lawrence is one of more than 50 authors included in the Haunted States of America. Welcome, William.
Hello, good to see you.
What is the Haunted States of America? What's the premise for this book?
This is an anthology of 52 stories for young readers, spooky stories, one from each of the 50 states, plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico.
And you're Kansas's representative in the Haunted States of America. How did that happen?
Well, I got an email that there was this contest, and they were looking for submissions for spooky stories from your home state. And as soon as I saw that, I said, oh, I've got to write something. And I thought about it, and the parameters were it had to be about a local legend or a local landmark from your state. And I didn't really know a whole lot of legends or stories about cryptids from Kansas. And I did some research on the internet. Nothing that I was seeing was really speaking to me. And suddenly it occurred to me, well, one of my favorite places in the state of Kansas is the Garden of Eden in the town of Lucas. And I said, that would be the perfect setting for a story. And as soon as that idea popped in my head, I said, I've got it. This is my idea. And I went with it.
The Haunted States of America was, I'm going to quote the book jacket here, made in collaboration with the SCBWI. What is the SCBWI?
That is the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. They are a professional organization that support writers and illustrators who create books for young people. So I'm a member of them. I've gone to their conferences. They're great. If any of you out there are interested in writing for young readers, I highly suggest you join. But I had been part of this organization for years, and they were the ones who sent me the email that this was happening. Without them, I wouldn't have known about this. And so they were the ones who put it together. And they collected all the submissions, and they chose which story would represent which state, and got this book off the ground.
You've already mentioned that this is an anthology for young readers. What do you see as the target audience for this?
I'd say upper elementary, middle school in there. It depends on kids' reading levels, but I'd say maybe like fourth, fifth grade, all the way through eighth grade.
And they're spooky stories, but they're not super scary.
Yeah, nobody's going to be traumatized by these stories. But they are fun, and I think they're delightfully scary. Something I think would be appropriate for young readers and also for adults, too. I think adults would enjoy these as well.
William, what do you think makes a good spooky story?
That's a good question. I think there has to be some sort of element of not knowing. So there has to be something that you can't see or that you don't know. And it's scarier to not know or not see it than it is to know what it is in front of you. So I think there's that mystery because it leaves room for your imagination to go dark places, which might even be worse than the thing itself.
It's always worse than the thing itself.
Yeah, I think it is.
Your story, Midnight in the Garden of Eden, is preceded by a really compelling illustration. Could you describe it for us?
Okay, so imagine it's almost like a pen and ink drawing. It has a very scratchy texture to it, black and white, and the statues of Adam and Eve are grabbing a little boy who's screaming and fighting for his life, while a snake is slithering around overhead. And I was so happy with this illustration. Our illustrator, Solomon Hughes, he's a fairly young guy who came into this project, and he had to read all the stories and come up with pictures for all 52 of them. I imagine it must have been a huge undertaking for him. Plus, he did the cover, so he had a ton of illustrating to do. He did a great job. He really contacted authors and had us be a part of the process. He sent me his sketches and said, what do you think of this? Does this work? And he even asked me, what do you think the boy should be wearing? And so I got to have some input in it. And he said that, you know, if there was anything I was opposed to, he would change it, which I wasn't. I just thought he did such a good job. But it was a really neat collaborative process, just getting to have some input, because I know that's not always the case with authors and illustrators. So I felt very privileged that he really did want my input, and he wanted me to be happy with it.
Can I have you read from your story, Midnight in the Garden of Eden?
Certainly. I was 6 when I saw Samuel Dinsmore. Mom lifted me up in her arms as the tour guide shone a flashlight on his glass-topped casket. Every hair of his long bristly beard was perfectly preserved, but his sunken face was rotting away, shriveled, covered in white, crackling mold. I wriggled out of Mom's arms and screamed my way out of the concrete tomb. I begged her never to take me back. But in Lucas, Kansas, you can never really escape the Garden of Eden. Every visitor to our prairie town stops to see the strange log cabin. Samuel Dinsmore built it from logs of limestone, not wood. He sculpted trees out of concrete, tall as telephone poles, and planted them in his front yard. He filled the branches with concrete people, Bible characters, common American folk, even animals. Tourists flocked from near and far for a peek at the home he called that gladly showed them around. Now, long after his death, he's still there, in a concrete tomb in the backyard. Before he died, he wrote that on some dark night in the future, he hoped to slip out of his mausoleum and look around. For years, the memory of his face haunted me. Anytime I walked down Kansas Avenue, I crossed to the other side of the street. I looked away, but the concrete people and the concrete trees never did. The back of my neck would tingle, as though they were watching me. I was 11 the day I met the dog. I was walking home on a windy September afternoon when out of nowhere he trotted up to me, a slender hound with short ears and a long tail. He licked my cheek and begged me with wide eyes to take him home. So I did. All right, we're going to jump ahead in the story just a little bit. It's nighttime now, and the dog, whom the boy has named Rocky, has woken him up. It was an especially dark night. The new moon meant no moon at all in the black sky, and I didn't have a leash, so I was determined to follow Rocky closely. But the second the front door was open, he bounded across the grass and down the street. I didn't even have time to think. My feet were racing after that dog, my heart pounding. I tore through the pitch-black roads, following the sound of Rocky's footsteps. He rounded a corner. I suddenly found myself standing at the edge of the Garden of Eden. The gate was open. He could have picked anyone's backyard. Why this one? I cringed as I entered. The gate creaked eerily. Above my head, words seemed to whisper in the wind. It sounded like, "He's here. He's here." But the wind stopped, and so did the voices. The door to the concrete tomb was wide open. "Rocky?" I gulped back my dread. I wouldn't take so much as a peek at the decaying corpse. I would just run inside, grab my dog, and hurry back home. The tomb was silent, only a small sliver of lamplight. No trace of Rocky. I turned around to leave, but something drew me back. Morbid curiosity pulled at me. I stepped up to the glass. The coffin was empty.
That's William Mockery reading from Midnight in the Garden of Eden. It's Kansas's entry in the Haunted States of America, a collection of more than 50 scary stories representing each state, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. Okay, William, I'm going to assume that Kansas and your story, Midnight in the Garden of Eden, is your favorite, but would you recommend another spooky story?
Ooh, yes. One of my very favorites in there was the Alaska story. I'm not going to give anything away, but once I got to the end, there was a twist, and I thought, wait, what? What? I had to go back and actually read it again, knowing the twist, and I was like, oh, now it makes sense. But that author had me fooled. So I'm just going to say, look for the Alaska story. I really liked that one.
That recommendation from William Mockery, one of the contributors to The Haunted States of America, an anthology of 52 spooky stories for our younger listeners, one representing each state plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. There are actually two Kansas authors in The Haunted States of America. Dr. Giselle Anatole is the director of the Hall Center for the Humanities at the University of Kansas and the author of the short story, The Jockey's Ghost. Giselle, it is always good to see you.
It's great to see you, too.
Explain this to me. You live in Kansas City. You teach at KU. How did you get into the haunted states of America representing Pennsylvania?
Well, when I saw the call for spooky stories, the requirement said that you had to have lived in a state for at least 5 years. And so I've lived in a lot of different states. So I lived in New Jersey. That was my first thought, that I grew up in New Jersey, but I was born in New York, and I lived in Connecticut, and I lived in Atlanta for a year. But I went to graduate school in Philadelphia. This idea of, I remembered being kind of horrified by seeing one of these lawn ornaments that I talk about in the story. I had seen them before, but I had always seen them painted white. So I was driving and saw one of these figures that was kind of in blackface. It had always haunted me. And so I thought that that would be the kind of center of the story that I wrote.
I'm guessing that some of our listeners may not be familiar with the kind of lawn ornament you're talking about.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the lawn jockey.
Yeah, so I go into a little bit of the history in the story itself, but if you don't know what it looks like, it's a little statue that stands on the lawn, and it's dressed in like a rider, the jockey horse rider clothing, like for races, like the Kentucky Derby or whatever it might be. Wearing a little cap and holding a lantern. A lot of times in post-civil rights, the 1950s, 1960s civil rights era, a lot of those got painted white. But prior to that, they were black-faced statues. They were very similar to... I always think of there are these banks piggy banks that are blackface that you used to be able to buy. They're very heavy metal, and you put a coin in, and they're blackface and very gruesome looking, like very the red painted lips, googly eyes, and then often when you put the coin in, the ears will wiggle, the eyes roll back in the head. And I have one of those. I was showing one of those to students for when I was teaching, actually, Toni Morrison, Beloved. I was teaching that novel, and there's a reference to an abolitionist family, and they have one of these statues that says "At your service." It's not a bank, but these statues got made into banks for kids later, and they reproduce a lot of like really racist stereotypes of black people, but not only the kind of grotesque facial features to make these figures are often ugly or are supposed to be funny, but a lot of them said "at your service," "at yo service," kind of mimicking this idea of African Americans as not knowing how to speak kind of standard English and standard written English, and they kind of emphasized this notion of black people as being servants, right? And in servitude after enslavement. And so I think they became really popular after the abolition of slavery and kind of going into the Reconstruction era. And so they used to populate lawns. At one point they were used, these little statues were used, they had, instead of a lantern, there was a metal ring that riders could, if you were riding before cars, if you were riding up to an establishment, you could tie your horse up to these, and they were very, very heavy, right? So again, the metal, making them kind of anchored into the ground or into the sidewalk or whatever it was.
And you would see these as far north as Pennsylvania?
Yes, and that was what, so I grew up in New Jersey, but near to New York, so I did not see them as a child, in Pennsylvania, I wouldn't see them in Philadelphia, but kind of driving out into the suburbs or into more rural areas. And so people are often surprised by that. I remember I was tremendously surprised. And again, I hadn't traveled extensively in the United States as like through my childhood years and teen years because my parents are from Trinidad. And so for our vacations, we would go to Trinidad or we would fly to the Caribbean. Like I hadn't really been, I hadn't been to the American South. I hadn't been, and my one set of grandparents lived in Montreal, and we used to drive up there. And I suspect we would have seen them, my parents driving, would have seen them maybe in upstate New York, in rural communities. But again, people thinking that they're small and that they're cute and that they're a piece of history, not necessarily always thinking about the feeling that someone would get looking at those statues. As I talk about in the story, sometimes people had them as evidence of, or not evidence, what is the word I want, to show a coded sign and symbol as a place on the Underground Railroad. So it was a kind of hidden sign, like maybe, you know, maybe it was light, the lantern could signify lighting the way. But perhaps also, you know, if a white person had, kind of hiding enslaved people, helping them farther north, they could be signifying, oh, like I have this statue which replicates these racist ideas so that no one suspects me of being someone who is helping enslaved people to find their way to freedom.
Again, that lawn ornament plays a big role in your story, The Jockey's Ghost. Can you read an excerpt from that story and maybe set it up for us?
Okay, sure. So in The Jockey's Ghost, we have Gio, who is the new kid in town. He's just moved. His parents have, he has grown up mostly in West Philadelphia, which is predominantly African American, or was at the time when I was living there. They've moved to the suburbs. And Gio is not happy about it, having been taken away from his friends and his, you know, home space. So he has not had a great day the first day of junior high, his new junior high or middle school. But he has made one friend, Craig, and so they are walking home together. When they pulled up to Gio's new stone home, Craig laughed. "Wow. I can't believe you have to live across from someone with a lawn jockey, and it's not even painted white." "What?" Gio frowned, looking across the street. A small statue of a black boy, really black, like Craig's hair, not the brown of Gio's own skin, stood in front of a clump of flowering purple azalea bushes near the neighbor's front door. It held a lantern aloft. Had it been there this whole time? Surely his parents would have said something while unpacking the van. "The big red lips around that toothy grin are super creepy." Craig gave an exaggerated shudder. "The whole thing is creepy," Gio retorted. "You know what it's supposed to represent, right?" At Craig's blank stare, Gio explained, "During the Revolutionary War, General Washington sneaked his troops across the Delaware River one night, from right near here, into Trenton. He left an enslaved kid at camp to keep watch and light the way back in the fog, but it was so cold that the lookout froze to death. He didn't go get a blanket or light a fire to keep warm. He just stayed in the spot where Washington told him to stand. Washington later had a statue called the Faithful Groomsman made at Mount Vernon to honor the kid." "Isn't that a good thing?" Craig asked. "No, it kinda says the only way for black people to be remembered is to be utterly faithful to white folks, or dead. Celebrating that kid because he gave his life for the cause, for freedom, doesn't acknowledge that he didn't have any choice. If he'd decided to save his own butt, he'd have been whipped for running away." Understanding washed over Craig's face. He cocked his head to the side. "Let's knock it over." Gio's eyes widened. "You want to get me arrested in my first week here? All right, all right. I'll do it myself." Craig trotted over. He gave the statue a solid kick, but it didn't budge. He leaned over and heaved, but it was no use. "It must be cemented," he yelled back to Gio. "I've got to get home, though. See you tomorrow, man." They bumped fists, and Gio walked his bike toward the garage. Maybe the day hadn't been so bad after all. Gio took a deep breath, but instead of new grass or the tulips in bloom, he was overpowered by that odor of rot again, mixed with manure. Unexpectedly, two frosty hands reached under the back of his hoodie and shoved him forward, hard, sending him and his bike sprawling. The hands weren't just cold. Each digit and palm seemed to burn its icy surface onto his skin. "You left me," a voice rasped. "You said you'd come back." Gio jumped up and looked around, but he was completely alone. Gazing back across at the statue, he started panting heavily. Hadn't it been angled toward the neighbor's front door to light the entryway? Now it was directly facing his own house and seemed to be staring at him.
That's Giselle Anatole reading The Jockey's Ghost. It's one of 52 spooky stories in the Haunted States of America, an anthology for middle school readers. Giselle, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really fun to be here.
And happy Halloween.
You too.
I'm Kay McIntyre. We'll have more KPR Presents coming up right after this. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for KPR Presents and NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 90.3 Chanute. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from Maselli's, catering to Lawrence, Topeka, Kansas City, and the surrounding areas for almost three decades. Available for wedding receptions, business meetings, or other special events. Details on catering and venue options at Maselli's.com. The holiday season will be swinging with KPR's Big Band Christmas. Join us Saturday night, December 14th at Liberty Hall. The Kansas City Jazz Orchestra will be on hand to provide big band hits and Christmas favorites too. Tickets are on sale now at the Liberty Hall box office and at Ticketmaster.com. Welcome back to KPR Presents. I'm Kay McIntyre. For the rest of this hour, the 2024 election is one of the closest in recent history. Just how much difference will split-ticket voters make? It's Beyond the Ballot, part two of a three-part series at the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas. This series is moderated by Jonathan Shorman, lead political reporter for the Kansas City Star. On October 9th, he was joined by Russell Fox, who teaches political science at Friends University in Wichita, and former Republican State Representative Stephanie Sharp, who now runs a consulting business, Vote Sharp.
I think that Jonathan asked me to come talk tonight because I've been doing Kansas politics for a long time, and there's obviously a lot of ticket splitting in Kansas, but it's usually within the Republican primary. People will vote Republican primary one way and one the other. But the work I'm doing now is at the federal level, which I've never really done before. And I just decided that I was really concerned about the future of our country. I went to a conference of disaffected Republicans in February called Principles First and met two other women there. And we hit it off and decided couple of weeks later that we were going to start our own super PAC. We were tired of waiting for people to act, and we said, we can do this. And so we are all suburban women, and so we said, we want to go after and target Republican women in the swing states to, at the time, vote Biden or write-in. That was the message at the time. And we were organizing and organizing and organizing up until July 1st, and we had planned to launch on July 1st, and then the June 27th debate, and then all of the drama. So that's what I'm working on right now. Our goal, again, is to move 100,000 Republican women now to vote for Kamala Harris in the general election.
So, Russell, what do we mean when we refer to a split-ticket voter?
There's a lot of different ways in which we can think about this. I mean, we can go back through history. You know, go back a century or more. All ballots were, by and large, provided by the political parties. And people would just, in public, you know, deposit their ballot already pre-marked for Republican or Democratic candidates. With the introduction of the secret ballot or the Australian ballot, it was called at the time, all of a sudden, those incentives that parties face change. They can't necessarily police their own likely voters any longer, and so they have to look to influence them. And of course, some parties are going to try to influence those that they know that belong to other parties. And so ticket splitting, the idea of consciously looking for voters who are likely to vote in a particular way as agrees with, you know, their likely ideology or their likely demographics, but for one reason or another can't support certain candidates. You're going to try to find those people and convince them to move. Who are these people? I mean, by and large, it's very difficult to give a Democratic portrait, or rather a demographic portrait of them. You have to look specifically at the types of candidates and the sets of voters that may or may not support those candidates. Now, what you were talking about, Stephanie, makes a great deal of sense, particularly in the context of a state like Kansas, okay? Historically, in the state of Kansas, the Republican Party has had a split between more moderate members and more, you know, radical, more constitutionalist, more libertarian, more deeply conservative members. And so the fact that there was already this division presents a lot of opportunity for people, again, like yourself, who take a look at the top of the ticket and they say, hey, we support traditional Republican Party values. We continue to endorse traditional Republican Party priorities, but we can't support this particular person. And we know why we can't support them, this person, because we think they're corrupt. We can't support this person because we think that they disregard our basic institutions. Well, that sort of appeal works well for people that are relatively well-educated, relatively well-informed, but were already maybe relatively moderate. So that's a perfect recipe to reach out to well-educated Republican voters, moderate Republican voters, maybe particularly suburban women Republican voters, and try to get them to split their tickets. Now, if you were to take a look at Arizona, or you were to take a look at Pennsylvania, the portrait of the ticket splitter there could be very, very different. But it's going to depend on some of the same fundamentals that I've mentioned already. Basically, you're going to take a look at areas where within party coalitions, you already see some divides, you already see some splits, and that's the sort of thing that maybe in particular situations might allow one party to really reach in, or dissidents within a particular party to really reach in and activate voters to move them in a ticket-splitting manner.
You want to add anything to that definition?
I love it. I would say the Rebel Alliance is what we often refer to. And Arizona is a great example. I think that there's a real opportunity to capitalize on ticket splitters if you're down ballot, right? If you're looking at a state like Arizona where there's Donald Trump on the top of the ticket and then Carrie Lake at the top of the ticket, and people are looking at those going, I just can't, right? If I'm a Republican down ballot, I'm going to be going for those people because we know that they want to vote Republican, but they just can't at the top two seats of the ticket. It's a real great opportunity, and I think you broaden the definition of what becomes a ticket splitter in that particular case. And we see the same thing in what was the other state that's got a big Florida isn't really a North Carolina is the other one, where Mark Robinson, the current lieutenant governor, is also causing some issues. And so you have Trump and Robinson as the Republicans at the top of the ticket. You have a whole bunch of Republicans in North Carolina that don't want to go there. And so, finding those people down ballot is a great opportunity.
The examples that you've brought up, and the examples that I'm sure most of the people here can think of in their minds, especially since 2016 and, Donald Trump's dominance over the Republican Party, the ticket splitting phenomenon has, really involved the question of what are Republican voters going to do, which one of those might be willing to bolt and support a Democratic candidate.
There are, you know, multiple Senate races, gubernatorial races across the country. I mean, certainly when you look at, you know, Laura Kelly right here in Kansas, the question has all been about what kind of Republican voters might split. John Tester's whole career in Montana is based upon the idea of finding the Republican voters there in Montana that will split. That is kind of interesting because if you look back a half century, if you look back to the 60s and the 70s, ticket splitting was mostly on the other side of the aisle. What you were looking at was a really well-established New Deal coalition that had, you know, was going on 30 years, 40 years of existence, and you had a lot of cultural change in the United States, and you had a lot of people that were, you know, getting frustrated with the way the country was moving. These were Democrats that were feeling frustrated with it. They weren't going to have a problem with voting Democrat down ballot. But when it came to the big national culture war issues, you know, they simply couldn't handle it. Democrats voting Republican were, you know, essential to the election of Richard Nixon in 68 and then in 72. They were absolutely essential to the election of Ronald Reagan. Probably not so much in 84, because by that time you had a real shift in party coalitions taking place. But in 1980, it was very real. I mean, the whole, you know, Reagan-Democrat phenomenon that a good number of people here are, you know, you'll remember this. That's where the ticket splitting was happening. So right now we see the activity amongst fissures within the Republican Party. Decades ago, the activity was mostly on the other side of the aisle.
So how often does ticket splitting really occur today? Because we have this national narrative that we're a 50-50 country, that it's, you know, going to be like 3,000 people in Pennsylvania that's going to decide the election. So how often are people actually crossing the aisle today in races all across the country? Because it seems like we have this narrative that doesn't really happen all that much anymore.
I think it happens less than people say it does. Okay. People want to say, oh, I vote for the person, not the party. It makes them feel good to say that, but how often it actually happens, we don't really, you know. I should say we know absolutely where you vote, when you vote, the exact minute that your ballot is cast. We don't know who you vote for, so I want to remind everyone of that. When it comes to... Oh, I lost my train of thought. You go.
Well, no, I appreciate what you were saying there, because especially in an era where there's so much misinformation about voting, and a lot of it conscious disinformation that's put out there, we really need to emphasize that when we talk about split-ticket voting, we're talking about a phenomenon that, you know, modern-day technology and just, you know, the brute work of counting ballots and, you know, lining them up along voter precincts, they allow us to get a pretty good picture of, you know, what sorts of people in what areas are voting split tickets. But it's not like we actually know who they are. We can't know that, and we wouldn't want to know that. And the people who say that they do know that, they're spreading, you know, false information about the way elections work. But yeah, I mean, we do know that, okay, so there's actually not that much ticket splitting in the state of Kansas, but we also know that Laura Kelly was elected because in about 7 counties across the state of Kansas, in particular in Johnson County, there were a lot of probably, again, going along with the demographic models we have of the people that live in different neighborhoods, probably a lot of college-educated women who had traditionally voted Republican, you know, they didn't want a return to Sam Brown back. They wanted someone different, not because they had become Democrats. Some of them had become Democrats and had started voting for Democrats regularly, but a lot of them hadn't. A lot of them split their tickets in order to support particular candidates. Nationwide, the data suggests that there is less ticket splitting than there was, like, say, a half century ago. But The thing is that the amount of ticket splitting maybe doesn't matter nearly as much as the question of how much ticket splitting there is in reference to the solid straight ticket voting that exists within your particular area. Look, a voter in California that decides to split their ticket between two different parties is almost certainly not going to make a difference. Same thing for a voter in New York State, but a voter in Arizona, a voter in Michigan, a voter in Pennsylvania, there it could make a big difference. Normally it wouldn't make a big deal in Kansas, except that we know that because of already existing fissures within the Republican Party, certain statewide races can really take advantage of it. So yeah, there's not as much of it as there used to be, but we're so polarized anyway, there are places across the country where it still can really matter. And the parties know this and are working hard to reach those people. People like yourself, activists like yourself, are part of that whole equation. You know those voters are out there. Let's try to find them.
This is a bit of a detour, but I am curious, how many jurisdictions around the country still allow for straight ticket voting? How many places can you still go in and pull the lever?
I don't know.
When I voted in Missouri, I was working on a campaign and living in Missouri. Don't worry, I didn't, you know. I was living in Missouri. I got to my book, and it was one of the Hanging Chad books in 2000, if you remember those. And you could push a button to push the pin all the way through and just say straight ticket Republican. And growing up in Kansas, I'd never heard of this before, and I was very young. And so I know that Missouri, I think, has changed that. And there are even some states that have it on their ballot this year. Mm-hmm. Either to do no more straight ticket voting or open their primaries or do ranked choice or blanket primaries. There's changes on the ballot this year.
This can, you know, really lead us into some deeply nerdy territory. Territory that, as nerdy as I am, I'm not terribly familiar with, but I know people who have looked at this strictly in terms of the technology that's available when you vote. When you are literally punching holes in a piece of paper, it's really not that difficult to create a machine that will allow you to punch them all at one time. But if you are, you know, working on a screen, I mean, yeah, it's easy to do on the screen, but you'd have to consciously do that. Whereas in the case of the hole punching, that's inherited technology that goes back years and years. So I know some people that have argued about split ticket voting versus straight ticket voting and say, well, the first thing you have to look at is what are the machines that they actually use in the voting booths. Obsessive dorks like myself that always use paper ballots and fill them in with, you know, pencils, there's no straight ticket option there. I mean, you have to fill it out yourself if you want that.
You were mentioning Governor Laura Kelly earlier, and that does lead me to a question of, to your point, there's probably fewer split ticket voters than we maybe think there are, but to the extent that people do cross over, is it easier for them to cross over down ballot as opposed to the top of the ticket? Or is the reverse true? What do we know about that?
I would think with my rose-colored glasses on about how public service should be done, in a lot of ways, it should be harder, not necessarily to split the ticket, but to vote just on party at the lower level. Well, first of all, because most state or county and city offices, school boards are all nonpartisan, so it's not going to be marked Republican or Democrat. That makes it harder. But also, you're more likely to know those people. And so I think it makes the splitting less relevant. And that's what I was going to add to the previous question, too, is that I think a lot of people may split their ticket without even knowing it because, for example, everybody has county commission races on their ballot this year. There's all these other partisan races and the county commission, which is nonpartisan. So you may be voting for someone based on the issues that they focus on at the county level, which are traditionally Democratic issues, but it's county level, so there's no party affiliation. So you may be splitting that, again, without even knowing.
Did you encounter a lot of people when you were running for office, when you would door knock, that they wouldn't immediately know what party you were, that you had to tell them, or?
I did always wear a red shirt with an elephant on my, sure, you know, T-shirt. So it wasn't often that, sure, and if you're walking doors in July,
right,
you're walking in a primary, which, right, used to be the only place that was really relevant, especially in Johnson County. Right. I should also say I'm originally from Garden City, so if there are any Western Kansas folks in here, and went to Southwestern. So, but I mostly got the question of, and this is, when I ran in 2002, we had, for those of you that remember the Montoy school finance case, that was in the very height of all of that. And so they would literally ask me, what kind of Republican are you? Or they would say, are you going to raise taxes for public schools? And they wanted the answer to be yes. And growing up a Republican, having just, I was in Kansas, I was in Johnson County for 2 years before I ran. It was a really strange place to be, to having that kind of a split ticket. People who were saying that they want you to vote yes on taxes for your schools versus a Republican Democrat.
I think your hopes for the level of civic engagement of American voters are not misplaced. I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons to be frustrated with civic activity across the United States, but I actually do think that you really do see on the lower levels a greater likelihood of people actually recognizing names, of people being able to connect local candidates with local causes, you know, making decisions on the basis of, a local sales tax, or, you know, a decision about a park or something along those lines. One slight correction, though, actually most county commission elections are partisan. Not all are, but there's a lot of county elections. I mean, right here in Douglas County, they're looking to move the county commission structure from 3 members up to 5 members. And part of that conversation has been the fact that Douglas County has been the only county across all the 105 counties in Kansas where Democrats have tended to dominate. And once they open it up to 5 and provide more representation for rural members of Douglas County, that's likely to change. But you're also correct that a lot of the time people don't know that. Mm-hmm. When I was researching counties across the across Kansas, it was actually really very difficult to find out if these people that had been elected county commissioners were Republicans or Democrats, because, of course, they didn't campaign on that. The only way that you would know was to take a look at, the election results report, the ones that are filed with the Secretary of State, because they'd have to list them as Republican or Democrat. So, yeah, on the local level, I think there's actually a lot of unknowing ticket splitting. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, nationally the conversation is about the sort of thing that you're involved in, where people are looking at the top of the ticket. And there's a lot of pressure not to do that because the parties are so polarized and the narratives are so divisive. But that's, in turn, what makes it so important, because there's going to be places across the country where those top of the ticket ticket splits can really make the difference. You know, you take a look at questions about whether, the Democrats are going to be able to maintain control of the Senate. Well, so much of that is coming down to a couple of Senate races where the Democrats are absolutely dependent upon a certain number of Republican voters splitting their tickets. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more action on the bottom of the ballot. A lot of that action we may not even be aware of. Of the stuff that's tracked at the top, it's less common, but therefore more important when it does happen.
Hey, your point about the local races reminded me of the race right now in Johnson County for sheriff, where basically Republicans, it's been almost 100 years since a Democrat has won the office of sheriff in Johnson County. It does seem to be competitive this year. That obviously raises a question of, what does it mean to be a Democratic sheriff versus, right, a Republican sheriff? And the answer isn't necessarily obvious.
And it gets really complicated, and this is taking us away from the topic. But the fact of the matter is that
there's still an awful lot of local control over whether a race is partisan or not. So you have an awful lot of county commission races all across the state of Kansas that are in fact partisan, but the very largest county in Kansas, Johnson County, that is by statute a nonpartisan race. It's a consolidated government, and you know they run without party labels. So it can change from one place to another. Most people would take a look at the question of Republican sheriff versus Democratic sheriff, and they would just find that odd. And yet, if that's the way they've always done it, there's going to be people invested in keeping it that way.
For candidates who are elected with that crossover support, how does that change how you approach being in office, knowing that you're only there because folks from the other side brought you there?
Well, in theory, when you're elected as a representative, you're not just elected to represent just the people who voted for you. You represent everyone, and so everyone should be telling you what their priorities are, and you should be taking that into account. Doesn't always happen that way, but I think it significantly changes the way that you campaign as well, the words that you say. I was just thinking when you were asking that question, with Women for Us, that's the super PAC that I co-founded, we went to both the Republican National Committee meetings and to the Democratic National Committee meetings, and listening to the Democrats, and I had worked at the 2000 Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. And listening to the DNC speeches this year, I could close my eyes, and it was the same words. It was the same intent. You could literally just change out the party affiliation. I think that because the Republican Party has gone so far to the right, there's been a lot of space opened up in the middle to grab those voters. We know, and I've been begging Republicans to do this for years, but we know that the left, far left Democrats, they're going to vote for the Democrat. So why appeal to more of us that sit somewhere in that middle? There's 10% on the right, there's 10% on the left. You know, in Kansas, it's probably more 13% on the right, 7% on, it's somewhere. Every state's a little bit different, but there's 80% of us that sit right in that middle. And if you only split the ticket one time, you know, if you have 10 races and you vote, you know, R or D at the top of the ticket, and then the opposite down the rest of the ticket, that still means that you're gettable by the other side. And so it should naturally change the way that you campaign. Obviously, it should change the way you represent. But I think that getting to the office, you have to talk like you're already there. You know, I used to tell my clients, act like you're the incumbent. Do all of the things that the best incumbent should do, and people will hire you to be their incumbent.
Your example, Stephanie, about, you know, the DNC, you know, listening to the speeches that were given at the Democratic Convention, I mean, I don't think any reasonable person can look at that and not recognize that the effort to reach out to voters that, for any number of different ideological or demographic reasons, would likely never vote for you, but are currently open to voting for you, is absolutely being heard. I mean, the language from the Democratic Party from the very top of the ticket on down in regards to the border, in regards to, you know, gun ownership. I mean, this is not language that is appealing to the really progressive side of the Democratic Party, because
they're already there.
I mean, obviously, you know, if you, you know, really want to get into this, there's a lot of worries about, oh, college students in Michigan may not support the Democrats, and that could put the state in play and all of those sorts of things. But broadly, nationally speaking, they know that there's far more moderate Republicans to gain than there are far left Democrats mm-hmm. to lose. And on a different level, you could say the same thing about, you know, Laura Kelly here in Kansas. I mean, you know, the stakes are not as clear, and the sorts of issues that have ultimately come before her to, you know, sign or veto or to campaign on, you know, have, you know, maybe not been especially nuanced. But nonetheless, you know, you could take a look at, you know, Laura Kelly's language when it came to, you know, dealing with any number of different culture war issues, and the simple fact that she consistently takes a Democratic position and then immediately pivots to start talking about schools, to start talking about Medicaid expansion. She has no interest in being a real warrior for the Democratic Party, not just because that's not her character, but because what kind of electoral strategy is that? The electoral strategy that works for Democrats in the state of Kansas has always been to go after the Republicans that are gettable. And, you know, that's why she won election and won re-election.
I think we'll see that in this year's general election results. I get a lot of questions, oh, I don't know, it feels like Kansas is going to vote for Kamala. And I say, no. That's just because of where you live and the little bubble that we, you know, where we live.
Yeah.
But I think what will be really interesting is to look at the percentages.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be closer than, well, certainly than it was in 16, or even in 20. But I think it will be much. I think it will be within a couple of percentage points.
The really interesting question, you know, for us that get into looking at these kinds of election results is, again, the down ballot question. You know, to what extent will someone who is saying to themselves, well, you know, I'm a Republican, but I can't possibly vote for Donald Trump, so even though it won't make a difference, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to vote for Kamala Harris, you know, will they also vote for Ace Allen? Will they also vote for, you know, one of these other Democrats that are trying to pick off a Republican seat? I mean, these are the seats that are going to make a difference as to whether or not the Republicans maintain their supermajority. And they have to be thinking to themselves, should I lean into, you know, the distaste that some Republicans feel towards Trump in the hopes of picking up some of those Republicans? I mean, that's a very difficult calculation when you get down to, you know, the local level, but it's got to be something they're thinking about.
One thing I wanted to ask maybe Stephanie first and then Russell is, I think in this discussion we should talk about unaffiliated voters.
Sure. Right?
Because, you know, a lot of people don't like to put that R or that D next to their name. And yet, I imagine when you, if you could actually look at how who they voted for, they might still be basically a Republican or basically a Democrat. So in your own work, as you're trying to attract these voters, what kind of role do independents or unaffiliated voters play in your efforts?
Sure. I think there's a lot of overlaying data that helps you find where these people, where their interests and their priorities are. For example, has someone always been unaffiliated? Or were they previously a Democrat? Were they previously Republican? And in what year did they change, right? Did something, what was going on the ballot in that year? Or culturally in the ethos that made them change parties? We've seen huge voter registration changes, you know, from Republican to unaffiliated in Kansas since Trump. And so you can take a look at their previous voter registration. You can also look at their voter history. When are they voting? Are they voting in the local elections? Have they ever voted in a Republican or Democrat primary? Have they changed their, you know, when, it's going to get a little deep into Kansas voting procedures, but
this is the place to get deep.
Right. As an unaffiliated voter, you can walk into the poll, ask to vote for, you know, the Republican ballot, and then I'm talking about the primary. You can ask for the Republican ballot or the Democratic ballot. They make you sign a form. You vote the ballot that you picked, and you walk out that party. Only if unaffiliated voters can do that. But it takes a little extra effort. You have to fill out an extra form. It just takes a little bit of extra time. So who are the people that were willing to do that, that are an unaffiliated voter but, you know, voted in the primary? And so finding those people is, well, I mean, obviously getting them to vote is a huge issue. But finding them and finding the issues where they're movable is really helpful. The constitutional amendment on abortion in the fall or August of 2022 is a huge marker for those of us that are in this work. If you're a Republican woman who's never voted in a primary before and you voted in that August of 22 election, I know exactly what kind of Republican you are. right? Yeah. Right? If you're an unaffiliated voter that was previously a Democrat and has voted in a handful of Democratic primaries here and there and voted in that primary, like, you know, just figuring out where the data goes, but then you can also buy a lot of data. And that's one thing that is sort of underlying this whole conversation is the other stuff that we know about all of you as you sit here, based on the types of contributions that you've made to animal organizations, healthcare charities, your church, any political cause, any of the magazines that you subscribe to. All of those kinds of things are public, not publicly, because you have to pay for them. You can buy that information. And so that's the kind of stuff that we use to find persuadable unaffiliated voters.
I mean, in theory, a lot of this information is publicly available. In practice, just the work that's involved in collecting it all and collating it all, that's where the real money comes into these sorts of things. Yeah. And again, you know, we should, you know, really emphasize, it's not like we're finding out how you voted. What we are doing is we're finding out how many people within the precinct that you live in have people that voted in this particular way and registered in this particular way, and you collate it with all sorts of other relevant data. And that's what enables us to get these pictures. I think Stephanie described it, you know, very, very well. The only thing that I would throw out there in regards to your original question, Jonathan, is let's make sure that we don't confuse unaffiliated with independent. Unaffiliated is simply the description of a voter who has never registered for a party and therefore has never participated in a Republican or Democratic primary in the state of Kansas. Some states allow unaffiliated voters to vote in primaries, and they can choose, you know, which party primary they support. You know, so we're identifying the people who just, you know, they vote in the general and that's it. And then there are the people who actually declare themselves as independents. The evidence across the country is that however many people may call themselves independents, functional independents are vanishingly rare. Most voters actually do not, in fact, approach every election with an entirely open mind and say to themselves, you know, do I support a stronger national border or do I support looser immigration now? I know what I thought 4 years ago, but what do I think now? You know, do I support higher taxes now? You know, most people don't change. And we recognize that even if someone calls themselves an independent, very likely they strongly lean one way or they strongly lean another. That being said, the unaffiliated category is so much larger than the independent category. So it's important to look at unaffiliated voters. And, you know, the point that you made, Stephanie, about us being able to predict how unaffiliated voters will break on the basis of a few key issues on a few key elections is really important. It's too bad we don't have more opportunities like the Value Them Both amendment vote allowed us. Now, I know for a lot of people out there, that's horrible because they say to themselves, no, I don't want something to be subject to, you know, just an up or down vote by the people. But for political dorks like me, the opportunity to see how people will vote when they're given a specific issue and compare that to how they vote when it comes to, you know, electing representatives, that's like a gold mine.
It is.
It's learned so much about Kansas in the summer of 2022.
Yes, yes.
And most
for
of us
or worse.
And most of us were so wrong.
Oh, well, so wrong.
You've been listening to Beyond the Ballot, the Ticket Splitting Voter. It was the second in a three-part series at the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas, led by Jonathan Shorman, lead political reporter for the Kansas City Star. He was joined October 9th by Russell Fox of Friends University and Stephanie Sharp, former Republican lawmaker, now with Vote Sharp Consulting. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.
Support for KPR Presents comes from the Midwest Trust Center at Johnson County Community College, presenting Paragon Ragtime Orchestra Sunday, November 17th at 2 p.m. Their presentation of Meet Me at the Fair is a musical celebration of the world's fairs. More at jccc.edu/mtc. And Bob Schwartz Financial, helping Kansans make informed financial decisions for their families for over 45 years. More at bobschwartzfinancial.com. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. And always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Dua Lipa usually plays for thousands in stadiums, but she recently stopped by NPR to play a much smaller venue, the Tiny Desk.
When you're just stood there in front of the microphone and you just can see eye to eye with so many people, it makes it so much more intimate. I crave moments like that.
Hear that conversation about her performance and new album on All Things Considered from NPR News. When the night ends up in tears,
wake up. Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 73 and fair. Wind is from the south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Wind will be from the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. It's 73 and fair.
Stay tuned for more KPR weather. I'm Maria Lopez.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
About a quarter in size, not a word was heard, not a soul alive. I turned around and I heard some jive. Spooks were playing a tune on a tombstone. Tried to run, but my doggies grew stiff. Shook in my britches and I felt mean if. A fiddle squeaked a high spooky riff, and spooks were playing a tune on a tombstone. The old town crier had given them their cue. The pilgrims there were square dancing too. While Pocahontas gave them a lift, on an each reel with Captain John Smith. When I awoke, the spooks had fled. Looked in the closet and under the bed. There on the floor was a book I read. No more spooky stories for me at night. I never, ever want to see another sight. Like the spooks playing a tune on the tombstone. We're playing a tune on a tombstone. Folks were playing a tune on a tombstone. The old town crier had given them their cue. Pilgrims there with square dancing too. While Pocahontas gave them a lift. Calling each reel with Captain John Smith. When I awoke, the spooks spooks had fled. Looked in the closet and under the bed. There on the floor was a book I read. No more spooky stories for me at night. I never ever want to see another sight. Like the spooks playing a tune on a tombstone.
That's Johnny Arcese, along with Nelson Riddle and his orchestra, Spooks Played a Tune on a Tombstone, 1953. It's a suitably sinister way to start the Retro Cocktail Hour's annual Halloween Spooktacular. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and you're the Underground Martini Bunker, normally the home of tiki torches and giant moais, but this week it's all set up for Halloween. So, instead of martinis, maybe we better switch to zombies. Whatever your beverage of choice, hope you'll chill with us for a round of classic monster pop as we visit haunted houses, monsters, munsters, mummies, and other people in show business. Coming up, we'll hear from a band called The Vampires. They really suck. Along with Bobby Boris Pickett, The Moonrays, Frank Sinatra, Sharky Todd and the Monsters, and more. We've got Edgar Allan Poe set to a big band beat. Music for Jack the Ripper, and of course, trailers for all your favorite cheesy monster movies. Trick or treat, it's the Retro Cocktail Hour on Kansas Public Radio.